Blog Talk Radio.
It's time to strap our boots on. This is a perfect day to die. Wipe the blood out of our eyes. In this life there's no surrender, and there's nothing left for us to do. Find the strength to see this through.
Hello, folks, and thank you once again to coming to Bard's Logic, Political Talk, part of the growing conservative conversation, and also part of the Patriot Journalist Network. You can find more of the Patriot Journalist Network and the Patriot Journalist Twitter team at www.patriotjournalist.com. Check them out, as well as checking out some of the friends of mine, such as Gordon Taylor over at the Patriots Bunker. And that's www.thepatriotsbunker.com, which will be the new conservative news source for us in the grassroots. And also check out the Overpasses for America, same address, that's www.overpassesforamerica. And also check out, of course, the Bard's Logic Political Talk website at www.bardslogicpoliticaltalk.com. Check out some of the pages we have there. We have a Get Involved page. We have some links to some of the websites I just told you about. We're going to update it in a little while, probably this weekend or so. And also check out the Give page, where we have some wonderful organizations, including how you can help out the Patriot Journalist Network as well. And tonight we have some very special guests on, and we have Dr. Evelyn Kelly and Natalie Kelly to discuss their travels to Cuba and Colombia. And, of course, callers and chat participation are welcome. So come talk with me, the host, our panelists, the guests tonight, and, of course, other audience members. So join our roundtable discussion as Bard's Logic welcomes our guests tonight. Now, as I said, Evelyn Kelly and Natalie Kelly are two conservative Americans who've traveled to 73 nations. They were struck by how America is slowly becoming and accepting the same philosophy that dominates Cuba. In December, they visited Colombia, where Cuban soldiers are present in Venezuela to bring the revolution to the countries where the economies are weak. Got here that says that Chavez dreams of making the United States of South America, and, of course, whose philosophy is Marxist. So the questions we ask tonight is the United States slowly sliding and accepting the philosophy to which our Constitution is diametrically opposed? Are we also like the citizens of great Roman Empire who gave up their freedoms for a little bit of pleasure? Dr. Evelyn Kelly and Natalie Kelly's goal is to understand the culture, history, and politics of the regions and how the United States fits into that picture. Evelyn Kelly is an educator, writer, and community activist. She has written 16 books and over 400 articles. She is also active in local politics and is a member of the Marion County Republican Committee. Natalie is president, founder, and partner of Acclaim Strategies, Inc., a full-service firm in Tallahassee that provides government consulting, direct lobbying, political consulting, advocacy, and grassroots development. And I like to hear that, grassroots development, and business-to-business strategies. She's also the president of Kelly Com, LLC, a public relations and communications firm. She has worked for both houses of the Florida legislature, including 10 years in the Florida Senate as staff director, communications director, and liaison with the Senate president. And, of course, Bard's Logic is the grassroots We the People show. And so without further ado, I will bring on our guest tonight, and that is Dr. Evelyn and her daughter, Natalie. Thank you. We'll put up your mic here, ladies. Thank you for coming to the show. I do see we already have some folks who'd like to chime in tonight. And we do have some interview questions that we have for the ladies here. And we also, when we bring in our panelists, so may have some questions or comments as well. And then we will be bringing in the audience questions and comments so they can join the roundtable discussion, as we do every night here on Wednesday nights here on Bart's Logic, and that is All Mics Stay Open. So welcome, Dr. Evelyn and Natalie. How are you tonight? Thank you for coming to the show.
Wonderful. Thank you, Robert.
Great. Well, you know, I had the opportunity to look over the PowerPoint presentation and talk to some of our audience members who have seen it, and thank you very much out there for those who brought you two to my attention. Of course, that is namely Harriet, who is a loyal listener here to the show. Okay, great. I see you there, Dan. I've seen your message on Facebook as well. That's one of the things, ladies, you'll see me talking to the people who are I'm multitasking here. I'm both on Twitter and the chat here in the room and also on Facebook. So I'm all over the place here as I'm hosting the show. So welcome, Dan. So, okay, ladies, we'll go in and get to our first question. I think I see you there as well, Kelly. It's great to have you on the show. And Kelly Mordecai is one of our panelists, and we'll talk more with him later. First, we'll start out is Evelyn and Natalie. I don't know why I kept calling you Nicole for a little bit, Natalie. I apologize for that.
That's okay.
But I have read some of your backgrounds at the opening of the show, as you heard. And could you elaborate on some of those points that you're most proud of and which ones you believe hold significance in your efforts to inform the folks in the comparison of what you see happening in America for the past several years? And what do you have seen of the people's quality of life in the Marxist countries you have visited?
Well, thank you, Robert. As you said, my mother and I have traveled to 73 countries in all seven continents. But we're not your typical tourists. In fact, we don't even call them vacations. When we travel to countries, what we do is we learn about the culture, the government, the politics, their education system, their healthcare system, and even try to learn some of their language. And over the course of 20 years that we have been traveling abroad, we've also learned a lot about Americans. We'll talk a little bit about that tonight. But, you know, as Americans travel overseas, they tend to look at the differences between how great we have it in the United States and that other country. For example, in Italy, you know, the pizza is not nearly as good as what we make here in the United States, or the toilet paper in Russia is not nearly as soft as the toilet paper here in the United States. And, of course, we have found that in Cuba as we traveled last February. But what was really interesting about our trip was what we saw, the similarities between the United States and Cuba. And I'm specifically talking about the similarities of the current progressive policies of this administration and communist Cuba. But what you need to know about us, we're not Cubans. We know a lot about it because we are from Florida and we have a lot of Cuban friends. And as we, when we came back from Cuba, we really started talking about this and talking before groups, conservative groups about this. And when we did that, we'd get a lot of phone calls back to talk about how, you know, they were part of the Bay of Pigs and what they had to do. So we really learned a lot this past year about Cuba and also about the United States and about Americans.
One thing we would like to emphasize is that when people travel across the ocean, especially to Europe, and they go into the countries like that have been behind the Iron Curtain or behind the Berlin Wall, and the Berlin Wall has fallen, and people see these countries, Hungary and Romania, and they are very progressive, and we begin to think, hey, look, communism is dead. But actually what is happening is that we are simply being lulled asleep because communism is not dead. It is only 90 miles off the coast of Florida. And this group that is off the coast of Florida is looking to transport that to the entire part of South America. So it is very alive and well, and I would say that is what we have seen. As far as the way of life,
I just heard from one of the audience members that they're having a little a bit of a possible volume issue. I don't know if that's across the board here, but I don't know if there's a way you could get closer to your mic or something of that nature so they can hear better. I apologize for that, but for interrupting, I just wanted to let you know. So maybe if there's something we can do with that, go ahead.
Okay.
That's better.
Okay, is that better?
Arlene, thank you very much for letting me know. I know you're listening on the show. I want to thank you for your message here on Facebook. So if you'd like to just let me know if that sounds better for you as well, or if someone wants to let me know in the chat, we'd appreciate it. Go ahead. Well, it sounds better for me. I'll wait for a response, but until we do, go ahead with where you're going.
Yeah, let me just make another point, because you did ask about the people's quality of life in these Marxist countries. One thing that we did note is that the individual in these Marxist countries, the individuals and the consumers are absolutely nothing. Everything belongs and everything is subservient to the state. For example, if you look in Cuba, one of the things that they asked us to bring when we went down there was soap, things that are consumer products that we think of as everyday products. These things are just non-existent there or are very low quality. So as far as the answers to the quality of life, it is really very, very low. It is country without freedom. And I would consider that as a very poor quality of life. Are you hearing us better?
Yeah, I'm having mixed results. I guess it depends on a few factors. I have some that said it sounds great, others not as well. It sounded a little bit higher for myself, but it just depends, I guess, on different feeds and things of that nature over the line, you know, online. So we'll just do the best we can and try and keep the volume up, and then we'll go from there. And perhaps, you know, for folks, they might be able to either turn it up, or there's a spot on the computer where they can go to the, I guess, a volume dashboard or something, turn it up or something. I don't know. But we'll try to do it on our end as well. So it's going to take me a few minutes to differentiate between the two voices, but that was Natalie and then Evelyn.
Do you want us to say who we are?
Go ahead. There we go. Now I go. So we will be bounced by you two ladies. So go ahead, Evelyn.
Okay. This was what I was just answering to your last question. Do you think we should slow down just a little bit? Because we have a tendency to speak fairly rapidly. We get very passionate and very excited about the topic. So if you need us to slow down, please just tell us that. So you can go ahead with your question.
That may help as well. We have plenty of time this evening as long as you ladies can stay on. And you're welcome, of course, to stay on for the full of the show. So, you know, we've got plenty of time here.
Great. So you want to go on with your next question?
Important information, sure. The second one is, you in the presentation, you give a short history of Cuba, and so if you could share with the audience which parts of the Cuban history you concentrate on and why you chose that part of history, Cuban history.
Of course, Cuba has a very distinguished history, and we began at the beginning on October 28, 1492, when Columbus landed there. And he said, "This is the most beautiful land that I have ever seen," which I think is quite a compliment. And Spain then claimed Cuba, and they ruled it for four centuries. And in that time, they built a wonderful culture, a culture of beautiful buildings and lovely architecture. And also they built large forts, of course, to protect themselves. In 1899, we'll go on into history, advancing a little, after 400 years of Spanish rule, the Cubans wanted their independence, and they called upon America to come to help them, or the United States to help them. And if you recall your history, this is when Teddy Roosevelt and his Rough Riders went down into Cuba, and they liberated Cuba. Now, our Cuban guide told us that it was not the Spanish-American War, but it was the Cuban-Spanish War. So we were corrected on that. Cuba then became a republic. They had several presidents until there was a guy whose name was Batista. And Batista decided that he was going to take over the government. So he performed a coup, and he took over that republic, and Cuba then became very, very wealthy because of other countries investing in it. It was very, very wealthy with sugar and molasses and rum and tobacco and fruits and all of these things. And it became also the playground of movie stars, of the rich and famous. And we went into one hotel called the Hotel Nacional, in which they had all of the famous movie stars like Dean Martin and Frank Sinatra's pictures there. So it was the playground of the rich and famous. It was also a very, very, very corrupt government. And this is what the people of Cuba began to resent. Even though they were wealthy under Batista, they had freedom under Batista, they still resented all of the graft and corruption that was present in that Batista government.
And this is Natalie. It was the way we saw it, it was a perfect storm because of the corruption that Batista brought in his government. They took, it was perfect for a young, charismatic, articulate man who's educated in the United States to take over Cuba and to sell himself as the liberator. And that is exactly what he did, with help from other friends as well. So that's when we go into the revolution.
Natalie, you want to add on to that?
Yes, I would just like to add that there are some individuals that you need to know their names. Of course, Fidel Castro. And the next one is his brother, Raul Castro. So many times we think of Raul as a sweet little brother of this guy. But actually, he was a cutthroat. Very much like this next guy, whose name is Che Guevara. Now, Che was an Argentine doctor, but he was also a cutthroat assassin who imprisoned and killed people that did not agree with him. So you can see that these individuals, Castro's, Che Guevara, all of these became very, very had a great hatred for the United States that they called the imperialists. So they began to court other countries like Russia.
And bringing it back to the Cuban Revolution of 1959, you discussed some of the actions the new Cuban government enacted. Tell us about those and what similarities you see happening here in the United States.
This is Natalie. They acted very swiftly. What they did is they came into Cuba and immediately they confiscated the private properties, the sugar, your big hotels like the Hilton, anything with the United States, they took that over. So the state, what they call the state, they took that over. They abolished religion, and Cuba was a very heavy Catholic country, so they abolished religion. They took away the rights to bear arms, They killed or imprisoned those who disagreed with the regime. They standardized national education. They controlled their elections. They also nationalized health care. And one other thing that they did, which is extremely important, they controlled the media.
So what would happen now with all of these things happening? The United States' interests in Cuba had been violated. They took over all of their sugar interests. They took over their hotels. And therefore, President Eisenhower in 1960, you might have thought that it was Kennedy that started the embargo, but actually Eisenhower started it in 1960. And then when Kennedy was elected, he continued it and took it on and kept the embargo. With that embargo, the Soviet Union began to just pour money into the Cuban economy. And they even did something that was even worse. Robert, you're being so young. Could you remember or could you tell us from your history what happened in 1962 that the Russians were doing right off the coast of Florida?
Was that the Bay of, I wasn't born yet, but is that the Bay of Pigs?
No, you get warm, yeah. Though. Okay, I'm going to have to give you a hint on this. It was called the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Cuban Missile Crisis. Okay.
Yes, have you ever heard of that?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I have.
Okay. It was, for those of us, now, Natalie wasn't born, but I was there. For those of us who lived through this, it was an absolute horrible time because we began to prepare for nuclear war. And what is interesting is when we went into this Hotel Nacional, they had an exhibit down there of how they were also preparing for nuclear war from the United States. But fortunately, it happened that they did resolve this issue, and Khrushchev took away those particular missiles that were there. We stood right in front of this hotel, right where those missiles were. It was quite an eerie feeling.
And what we have to remember, what the callers need to remember, is the fact that Cuba is just 90 miles south of Florida, just 90 miles south of Florida. And to have these nuclear missiles and the missiles that we actually were able to see right there at the site of the hotel, which was in Havana, which is the most northern part of Cuba, which is the most closest part to the United States. So there are missiles just right off the United States. And really, it's hard to even, you know, when you talk about it, and yes, you see the map of Cuba and you see where it's in relation to the United States, but it's really eerie to think. And when you go to Cuba and you see that, you see and at Hotel Nacional, you're looking right there on the beach, you're looking north, and just 90 miles north is the state of Florida. And so it's just very eerie. It really hits home, and you really understand how close, not only just in proximity, but how close we came to a nuclear war.
Incredible. What were your memories of that, Evelyn?
My memories were there because I was the one that lived through it. Natalie was not born then. She is somewhat your age, and I was there. but I would like to say a little bit about the Bay of Pigs invasion. This was in 1961. Actually, it was a year before the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Okay.
And this is when a group of 1,400 Cuban exiles that had left because of Castro's oppressiveness that they left, and they decided they would go back and try to invade Cuba. And it was botched from the beginning. Our government was supposed to support them, and they didn't. So therefore, they had a tremendous defeat. And it permanently strained the relations between the Cuban American community and the Kennedy administration then. Want to bring you a little bit more now because we do want to focus more on Cuba today. But before I do that, I would like to say, now, we had the Russians there, and Cuba got a lot of money from them. Oh, they were really living high on the hog there. They were happy, okay? In 1980, there were terrible economic problems, and more Cubans then left for the United States. There was a group called the Marielitas that left, and we had a host of these that came and settled a lot in Florida, but many in other states too. In 1989, the Russians left completely, and they left them with a terrible economy, shortage of food. There was no electricity, and this beautiful land that Columbus saw in 1492 became a very, very, very sad land.
Now, Evelyn?
That was Evelyn then.
Well, see, I did it again. I tell you. Well, I'm looking at the PowerPoint right now, and then, you know, you talked about some of the actions that they took. They confiscated private property, abolished religion, took away their rights to bear arms, killed or imprisoned those who disagreed with the regime, standardized education, controlled elections, nationalized health care. I asked the folks, and, of course, the answer is obvious, but where are we hearing this now? I mean, we're hearing these sort of actions taking place right here in the United States.
That is true, and what this is Natalie, and what we're going to do, we like to kind of go through these and a little bit more, some of the other things that we saw as well, but we'd like to go in a little bit more detail on each of these.
Certainly.
And this is Evelyn now. If I could bring you up to date to where we went to Cuba in February, and this is what we saw. The foreigners have it good. Tourists are wonderful. They have it good. They are treated like royalty. But the Cuban people are very oppressed. So this is one of the things that we noticed. They really wanted us as tourists to see and to be treated well and to say, hey, look, this government is nice. It's just like when the singers, who was it, Beyonce. Went over there and they treated her like royalty. Well, we were treated like royalty. But then they didn't fool us because we saw what was happening to the Cuban people. And this is one of the things that we thought was just so very, very interesting, is the way that they treated us as tourists.
But, Robert, I want to add something. This is Natalie. I think
sure.
What the surprise about the Cuba trip wasn't the propaganda, their spin, the beauty of the country, because I know that they knew it was beautiful, but I think the biggest surprise of the trip was the American traveler, the Americans that come on this trip, that get these person-to-person education visas, usually they're very educated people. They've traveled a lot, so this is not their first overseas travel. But what scares me, what scared us, and what one reason why we want to get this message out is the fact that Americans are very naive. They're very ignorant to, you know, to policies, and we're so used to our way of life, and we're so comfortable with that, that when we go to other countries, we're looking, you know, we don't see those subtle images, and they take us to certain areas, and we're saying, oh, how beautiful Havana is, how beautiful Cuba is, how nice the people are. Well, it is nice, and it is beautiful. But they're taking us, they are in complete control. they take us where we are supposed to go. We're not going to see the back streets of Cuba. We're not going to see, how little food they have in the refrigerators. They won't allow us to look at that. What they do is they completely control our trip, just like they control everybody's trip that takes a visa to visa or person-to-person visa down to Cuba. So that is the one thing, and we're going to go into a little bit more about it, but what I want to do is talk a little bit about these issues, and we're going to start with the economy.
Is that okay, Robert? This is Evelyn again.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead.
The economy is the strangest thing that you have ever seen. As we said, we have been in 73 countries. We were in Russia right after the wall fell. We've been in communist China. But we have never seen anything like this. In Cuba, they have what is called two currencies or a two-tiered economic system. When we first go into the airport, we have to change our American dollars into CUCS, C-U-C-S. A CUC is valued at about $1.25, okay? Now, this very, very bizarre system is like this. All foreigners or Cubans that can buy from other stores must pay in CUCS, but their salaries, the money that they receive, is done in pesos. So they have two-tiered system, the CUCS and the peso. The peso is worth 1/24 of a CUC. Now, 80% of the people work for the government, and they get paid in pesos. But if they buy anything outside of the government stores or from the ration stores where they're given to them, they have to buy it in CUCs. So you can see how limited the buying power is. So let me just go ahead and give you a price list that we saw a couple of the things. For example, if you want a tube of toothpaste, it costs 1.5 CUCs. Now, if you are getting paid in pesos and that is worth only 1/24, you can do the math quickly kind of in your head. Hey, look, they don't have a whole lot of money. If you buy an electric blender, that costs 113.6 CUCs. A sofa is 597.35 CUCs. You can go into the government store and buy a very, very low-grade soap. Now, I know, Robert, you don't remember it because you're too young, but some of your listeners might have remembered the old Octagon soap, or what they used to call Grandma's Lye soap. Very, very strong. So soap is at that great premium. They can buy soap in the government stores in pesos. But if they go outside and buy other things, they have to buy in CUCs. So am I coming across on that as to what it is like?
Well, yeah,
you understand that?
It must be very expensive to buy anything simple, what we would think would be simple commodity now, such as toothpaste.
That is why I'm saying, no deodorant. There is no deodorant.
Oh, can't imagine.
So you can see that the buying power, and this is what I said at the very beginning, the individual is nothing. Consumers are nothing. It's only the big items that go into the government and how the government thinks that they can dole it out to the people. This is the way of life in a Marxist country. So let me just continue a minute on what we call the ration stores. Ration stores are very interesting. This is where people go each day And this is what they get each day. They have a little ration book. And, Robert, again, I will say this to you, but some of your listeners may remember there were times when we had rationing in the United States during the time of war, okay? But these were books, and they would take their ration book each day, and this is what they can get from the ration store. One roll, 1 pound of rice, 1 pound of black beans, and all of this is per day. This is what get free.
Real quick, ladies, I've got some people asking, is there a website where people could see your PowerPoint presentation? I know you emailed me the actual PowerPoint presentation that you did from Microsoft. But is there a link or something folks can get that at?
I can get it up. What is the best way for me to do that?
Well, I tell you what, I have it in my email, and anyone out there who would like a copy of it, what I could do is just contact me from the contact page on the Bard's Logic Political Talk website. So go to bardslogicpoliticaltalk.com, go to the contact page, and ask me to email you, send you a message and say you want me to email you a copy of the presentation, and I will I'll send it that way. That's probably the best way.
Because, listen, we cannot say in words what we have pictures of, and you know that because you can see it. But these pictures are so powerful. When you look at this ration store and see that on the shelves, there's nothing. It is just amazing. When you look at the infrastructure, and you look at a building, and it has all of these wooden props up, you say, oh, look, in the United States, we would think, if we were looking at a building like this, we'd say, hey, look, they're doing renovation. That's not what they're doing. They're propping it up so it won't fall because people live in these houses.
Someone said email in the chat, email the just after NSA. Thanks, Trog. I appreciate you coming to the show and participating in the chat. It says just after the NSA, they probably already have it. So thank you very much. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I just
You can interrupt anytime. I want to talk a little bit. This is Natalie. I want to talk a little bit about the transportation. I know that you see pictures of Cuba and you see the old cars, the 1950 cars, and a lot of people say, oh, that's so neat to see that. How cool is that? But what they don't understand is that was somebody's car. In 1950, that was somebody's car that left Cuba or was missing, and it was taken away from them and inventoried and still being used this day. But those cars that you see on the roads of Cuba, they're not being driven by, you know, just a regular Cuban going to work, because they can't afford cars. What they are is they use them as taxis now. Since tourism is really developing, they're using them as taxis. And therefore, you see more of these. But what's really interesting is right before Christmas, I was watching Fox News, and there was a ticker on the bottom, and it said that Raul Castro is now allowing Cubans to buy new and used cars. Well, I just had to laugh because what a joke is that? They can't even afford cars. They can't even afford the gasoline to drive a car. So, sure, he's now allowing people to buy cars, but they're not buying cars. But the difference is this. That was on a ticker on Fox News where Americans are seeing that, and they're thinking, well, Raul Castro, gosh, he may not be nearly as bad as his brother Fidel. He's allowing
Americans now, you know, to get visas. We can go, you know, they can go down to Cuba. He's accepting that. He's allowing some things to open up. He's allowing Cubans now to buy cars. He may not be nearly as bad. Maybe things are changing, but we're soon going to find out that is not the case.
I think look at those cars, speaking of those cars, it's really kind of funny because they are taxis. And we had an occasion in which we had to use a taxi to go to a Paladar. A Paladar is a restaurant that the government is letting people do kind of on their own, and it's usually in a home. So we went to this restaurant called a Paladar, and we got had to go in a taxi and get the taxi back. It was really strange because the door was tied on. The paint, they have several different colors of paint. The backs, the trunk, what they do whenever they go and fix up these cars, they just find any part from any kind of car anywhere, and they put it on there, and if it sort of halfway fits, it becomes part of the particular car. So we weren't sure if we were going to get back to the hotel or not in this taxi. So we look at them on the road, and we look at them, and a lot of people laughed at them. But really, when you think there was somebody's car that they just confiscated, that it is a sad situation.
And the same goes for housing as well. There's so many beautiful homes in Cuba, especially in Havana, where we were at. But the problem is at one time they were extremely beautiful. But now nobody fixes those. Nobody, you know, many families live in one home. And so the infrastructure, not only just with buildings but with houses, they're really poor. And the sad thing is that, you know, they don't have the money. They don't have the money to fix the infrastructure. And, of course, the state's not going to put money into it unless it's going to be an area that they're going to take the tourist so the tourist would see how beautiful these buildings are. You know, Spain put a lot of money in a few years ago into the downtown plaza area. And, of course, that's the first place they take tourists to the downtown plaza area to see how beautiful it is. And it is beautiful. Mm-hmm. But you're talking about side streets in other parts of Havana and other parts of Cuba, you will not see that. Another thing that really struck us is the control of the media. And we knew that. We knew that Cuba had a control of the media, the TV, state-owned TV, state-owned radio, state-owned newspapers, complete control of the Internet. However, what tourists don't know is that when you go into a hotel that they place you in, and we stayed at the Havana Libra, we found that they get CNN, they get Fox News. We were watching all of that in the hotel. But what's interesting, again, were the Americans who actually thought that because we get Fox News in our hotel, that everybody gets Fox News. And, of course, that is not the case. It's completely controlled by the state, but they don't tell you that. And if you're not an astute tourist, you're not going to know that. You're going to think that, well, they get exactly what we get. So, you know, what are they talking about? Life is really great here. But that is not the case.
Mr. Evelyn, I'm going to go ahead and go through this. You're asking us to point out some similarities that we feel is coming.
Right.
We are looking at, and this is an area that I'm particularly interested in, is in education. Immediately, Castro went in, and he standardized education. Now, it is free education. They had free education before. But what are they going to do with it? They tell individuals what they are going to study and place them in areas that they think, according to exams, where they should be. We went into a couple of schools that they were so proud of. And as a supervisor of interns, and I go into schools all the time, the education system that they had was really very, very, very backwards compared to what we have. They have a computer lab that had three old cathode ray computers. Those are those great big old PC computers. And they were so proud of having a computer lab with three computers in it. All throughout their school, all throughout their bulletin boards and so forth, we have pictures of Che Guevara. And whom did we say Che Guevara was? A cutthroat assassin who was trying to import all of communism into all of South America. And he was killed in Bolivia. Therefore, he's one of their heroes. And they have his picture on lit up on the communist headquarters. Natalie asked our guide why they had Che's picture everywhere. And she said because he's dead and Fidel is not dead yet.
Well, and then another thing is, and I'm going to bring it, back to here is, about the controls, because you also mentioned that as well. You discussed how the Cuban regime maintains control. So how is this done there, and which of those do you see are being here done by our government today? You mentioned education. That sounds a lot like Common Core, what's going on here.
Hey, that was in my slide, and I didn't put it in, did I? I didn't tell you about Common Core. Actually, this is, what is Common Core anyway, except it is the government trying to control the education of all students in the United States. And as an educator, I understand standards, certainly, but what I see with Common Core is the approach and the way that it is being implemented. And I have great reservations about this race to the top. I see they're trying to do the same thing with American education that they are doing in Cuba, which everybody is on the same page at the same time. Unfortunately, that's not the way we work in America or in the United States. We have states' rights, and the states have the opportunities to educate their children because we have different needs in different states. So that is one of the things that I really see that is an important likeness that they have.
And another one, this is Natalie, and this is the big one. This is the big one. It's the control and the nationalization of healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
In Cuba,
huge.
This is it. This is the big one. This in Cuba, they have a standardized or national healthcare system. They had a very similar system even before Castro came in. But you have to remember, it was a very rich country. And so a lot of the money that was coming in from the United States and so on really came in to pay for their healthcare system. But when Castro came over, the very first thing he did is he taught everybody how to read, and he standardized their education, but he also created a universal healthcare system. But it really became, even though they touted it as the best healthcare system in the world, it is the worst healthcare system in the world. You're only getting the spin. And let me tell you a little bit about that healthcare system. The clinics are poor. Buildings are in poor shape. They need to be repaired. They're extremely outdated. Poor equipment. There's absence of needed drugs.
There is no freedom for choice for a doctor. You just don't even have that. That's not even a concept. It's not even there. They've lowered their standards for a medical license, for a medical education, because there have to be so many doctors. You have to take care of so many people that they've had to lower their standards. And therefore, their doctor's salaries are extremely low. In fact, we talked to many Cubans that a lot of doctors are actually moonlighting as taxi drivers.
But doctors actually make $785.35 a month, okay? Compared to U.S. dollars, that's $30 a month. So what is the buying power? You can see that if you take that 24 factor, that actually the doctors have really about 32.72 buying power in Cooks. And as Natalie said, you may find doctors driving those taxis. And what is interesting, you remember we mentioned the fact that the salaries range from about 9 to pesos a month, several pesos a month. Can you find it? Let me see if I can give you a quiz, Robert. Who or what group of people do you think makes the most money in the Cuban system?
I'd say either the politicians or the military.
Politicians and the military, they are taken care of, but they are not the highest paid. Guess again.
You know what? I have no idea. But unless I have no idea that over there, I'll be honest.
Okay. The salaries range from about 250 pesos to about 900 a month. The ones that make 900 a month pesos are those that are in the transportation industry or in the tourist industry.
Oh well, yeah, that makes sense.
Because why? They are the ones that spread the propaganda to all of these tourists that are coming in.
Yeah,
so it is really an interesting thought to think that they are the highest paid. Plus, whenever we give them tips, we don't have any pesos. We have only kooks. So we give them tips in kooks. So they make quite a bit in kooks, as well as being the highest paid in pesos.
And I want to continue looking at some of the similarities. And this is what really scared me when I went to Cuba. They control all the guns in Cuba. And the issue is this. When I told you they walk us down a certain path, and they did, and they walked us by this building, and this building was open, and it had security guards. And in that building, there were just lines of rifles and guns and shotguns, and you had guns from Che Guevara and Fidel Castro, and the tour guide stopped to tell us about how this is a museum. And they're very proud of this museum because these are all the guns in Cuba. And the people in Cuba don't have guns. And she proceeded to explain the reason why. Because when they come and they talk to tourists, when these tour guides talk to tourists, they always use the United States, the imperialist, as examples. And she said, you know what just happened just a month or so ago? Now, this was last February. So, and what happened in Newtown, where somebody came in to a school and and shot school children. She said, that would never happen in Cuba. And the Americans were sitting there like, yes, we remembered how terrible. She goes, that would never happen. We have controlled that. We don't do that here. And, of course, the Americans are standing there saying, oh, well, we need to do something about ours. This is terrible. And it was terrible. It is terrible. But I asked her, I asked the question, so you're telling me there's not a single gun except for this museum here. There's not a single gun in Cuba. She said, no, I'm not saying that. The state, meaning the military, the politicians, the leaders, they have guns. And I said, really? I said, so why do they have guns? And she said, because they protect the Cuban people. See, the Cuban people don't need guns because our leaders will protect us. Just look at Americans like, are you serious? You know, do you see what's happening here? They took the right to bear arms. So therefore, no one can stand up against the state.
Against government. That's definitely something that it looks like that in our government, of course, and that's one of the ways that it looks like we're trying to slip it to communism, you know, here in America by our government. But I'm going to change things up just a little bit because it is about the top of the hour here on the show, and I do have some folks who would like to chime in. And first we have here one of our panelists on the show, and that's Kelly Mordecai, author of The Hidden Fourth Branch, and also a website of the same name. And then we also have Dan on the line as well. And we have some others who are listening. So if you'd like to chime in, just call in at 347-945-7428 and then push 1 on your number dial if you like. I do have some other questions that, I will ask later that I've had about the PowerPoint presentation, but we can get back to those later. But I do want to be able to bring in some panelists and some callers in as well. So without further ado, I'll be bringing you in, Kelly. Thank you very much for calling to the show. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing great, man. This is really interesting. There was a movie I watched years ago. I think it was Havana Nights, about this takeover in Cuba, and it was frightening. Due process was terminated, and basically if you didn't like what Castro did, you were dead. I mean, no trial by jury, no. They had such similarities between us, and we were such beautifully strong allies with Cuba. And then Castro just didn't want anybody threatening his power. We was fit recently just a substantial amount of time discussing how poor Cuba is. And I pretty much know the answer for this question, but I want to go ahead and answer it and make a comment. So let's pretend that I'm in Cuba, all right? I file a couple of patents, or as the British would say, patents. All right, so I file patents. Who owns it, me or the state?
I'm not sure that I would know about that. I would assume that the state is all-encompassing because the individual is nothing. I am assuming that. This is Evelyn, by the way.
Okay.
Is that what you have experienced too?
Well, I'm in California, the other sea in the world that's got communism. There's communism in Cuba, China, and California. There's something absolutely fundamental about the history of feudalism. You know, so you live on a baron's land in England, you don't get to keep the extra. You just barely keep alive. It was feudalism. It drove people to the American colonies where, oh, my gosh, you mean I can have this land and I work hard for it and I get fully rewarded for my work? Oh, my gosh, Constitution came along. Patents. It's called intellectual property, in which I filed a couple, by the way, a couple patents. But the intellectual property, this is a weird thing, but it works with greed, okay, greed. Let's suppose I want to make a whole bunch of money, okay? I'm a scoundrel, but I can have decent enough ethics, but you know whatever, okay? I want to invent something, okay? The weird thing about writing the patent clause in our Constitution it causes people to be motivated by greed to invent something. We have been the world leader in technology for, what, 100 plus years now? That greed is a motivator. However, what happens here is everybody in the community is blessed, is benefited, is more fortunate because we have all this technology and all these devices because somebody was greedy. Patents protect the intellectual property, and it motivates people to invent and improve our standard of living. And obviously the founding fathers of our Constitution thought this through, but in Cuba, if you invent something and the state just takes it away and then starts manufacturing, what is the motivation to invent a unique device?
What I see on this, and this is, now this is our experience, there was little motivation about anything. Even just small businesses, they were so thankful to be able to sell postcards that I really can't see them doing a whole lot of inventions. Let me just say this also. I work as a medical writer, and I hear a lot about some of the treatments and so forth that they have in Cuba. But the big thing about it is it's not shared with the other groups of people. There are no peer-reviewed journals that send it out so that we have any information about it. So I'm not sure. Actually, if you will look at it this way, Kelly, the people are not motivated to do anything. As I read on one statement, it said, you know, they pretend to pay us, and we pretend to work. So this is kind of what a communist society does bring in. We are there. We barely exist, but we have no motivation to do anything else. And that is what we saw on this particular island among the people.
Wow. Well, I just want to throw out some more comments. You know, there's some good dads and stuff, and here in America, the local print shop, he's encouraged his daughter to make these cards. They're custom cards, you know, and a cute little thing. I'm like, oh, wow, I think I bought one or two. But it motivates kids. I got a buddy who's got a hot dog stand, and his kids are going through the process. When I was growing up on an Iowa farm, I was raising sheep. I mean, my gosh, I mean, some years I made really good money, some years not so much, but I learned a ton about business. Motivation. Of, oh, gee, I can go on this enterprising adventure and I can actually make money. It motivates people. It gives them an enormous amount of drive. But when...
This is one of the slides that we have. Of course, you can't see it because you don't have it. We have one that we call controlled business. So even if they are motivated to have their own little card stand or little jars of fruit or honey or whatever they're selling, even if they are motivated, they still have to pay a whole lot of it, a large portion of it, to the government. We went to a market in which there were painters there, and we saw these really neat paintings. And Natalie and I, she bought one for $5, and I bought one for $10. And it was great, but these people are going to have to pay a portion of that to the government. So, as you said, what is their motivation? It may just be to get the eke a little bit of what they can out of it.
Wow. Well, a lot of people are there in Cuba are probably stuck between a rock and a hard place. They have all their friends and their family and their children, and they're working hard. And I'm maybe not working hard. I don't know what they do for... I'll bet the family's destroyed.
Would that be an understatement, ladies?
No, I think, you know, the family of the Cuban family is a very strong family network. We even see that here in Florida. You know, they really do take care of each other, and they do that in Cuba as well. And really, frankly, when you talk about the motivation... The motivation for the Cuban people is survival for every single day. That's the motivation
wow.
for Cuba, living for their family. You know, they have no religion there. Castro abolished religion. So they don't have, you know, that type of faith. I'm sure they have their own faith and maybe hope, but we don't even see that. They are friendly people. They love their music. They love their art. Just incredible painters, incredible artists. But it's living day to day. And, you know, you really have, you know, when you're giving that, you're given a certain amount of food, and everybody lives that way. That's just how everybody lives. And it's not like you have anything to push for, like in the United States, I want to build a business, I want to do that, I want to have this, I want to have that. You know, I want to have this for my family. That's not even the case. It's to go to the ration store every day and to get their amount of ration, their food, to bring it back to their family. They have a very strong family network.
Well, that's interesting.
And real quick, Kelly, before I move on, I do have another call I want to bring in. So we'll bring in Dan, and then we'll get some comments or questions from him, and then we'll bring it back to you, Kelly, and then we'll bring it back to some of the other questions that I have.
Okay.
And so at this point, we'll bring you in. Dan, thank you very much, Dan, for coming into the show. How are you?
Pretty good. Thank you for inviting me, Bob, and the ladies are wonderful. Thank you. And
Thank you, Dan.
Yeah, I'm Dan Gray. I write for the Washington Times Communities and a dozen other places and speak. I was actually born in Argentina, where Che Guevara came from, American parents, and I was born on the day of the Bay of Pigs invasion, which failed because the CIA failed to give naval and air support that was promised to the Cuban patriots. I've been taking notes. This is very interesting, and I just wanted to make a couple of points. The Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, unbeknownst to Americans, it was actually a trade-off. Khrushchev did not back down. He swapped missiles that we had. Atlas is based in Turkey, which are ICBMs very close to the Russian border. The Marielitos in 1980s were prison releasees. Many were political prisoners and just decent folks, but there were quite a few criminals, and that caused a major problem here in this country, just like we're having with illegal aliens today. A lot of decent folks, a lot of criminals, can't really vet them. Basically, what I've been noting is a tendency to look at this as communism. I don't care what you call it. You can call it by whatever name you want. In this country, they call it progressivism. In Britain, it's Fabianism. Some Scandinavian countries call it socialism. We've had fascism in Italy and national socialism in Germany. It's totalitarianism, basically kings. But today they have a sophisticated method available to them with technology of control. And just like kings, the divine right of kings has become an unquestioned belief. And you don't question the king. You don't question the regime. If you speak up, and it doesn't even have to be ideological, the Ba'ath Party, which ran Iraq under Saddam Hussein, if you spoke in class as a teenager, you know how irreverent teenagers are by nature, and said something wrong, your whole family was in jeopardy. But technology, which we have, is a double-edged sword. From the days of written language and bronze swords to today's microchips and internet, it's double-edged. They have mastery. Look at the NSA, which you joked about earlier, Bob, and or one of your callers did, or somebody wrote in a message to you. It's no joke, but I'm multitasking too. I've got the email and Facebook and Twitter and all this stuff going right now, on a telephone, on your wonderful show. And we have the opportunity to take it back. If we don't, I don't think Cuba is our ultimate goal. That's bad. But the people there do live. What I'm afraid of is what happened to Europe when it just caught fire in the late 30s and early 40s. And there were millions, not just my own family, of which only two survived. I'm Jewish. In Poland, but 100 million Russians were killed, unknown numbers of ordinary civilians. Greeks were killed, Italians were killed, French were killed, and we're not just talking soldiers and when you look at the path that all these countries take, whether you call it communism or something else, it leads to what Cuba has today, which is like feudalism, like your other caller mentioned. On the other hand, you continue down that path and put one psychopath in charge who hasn't got... Just imagine if Che Guevara had actually inherited the revolution. If for some reason he was ruthless enough, or maybe some patriot or a CIA assassination plot was effective enough to get rid of the Castro brothers, Che Guevara would have been running it. Unlike the Castros, who just like power, he liked killing people. He murdered thousands. He reveled in it. A man like that in charge would be as bad as Hitler was, as bad as Stalin was. I talked to a lot of progressives. That was my roots. That's how I grew up. And they'll tell me, well, I'm not worried about Obama. I said, well, you know, and I was really wasn't that worried about Bush. They're both against our Constitution. They're both growing statist government. They're both diminishing our rights and spending us into oblivion. But I don't think either of them are necessarily psychopathic. I'm not too sure about the current guy, but I don't think so. But are you willing to trust anybody with that kind of power? How do you know what the next person is going to be like? When I look at Cuba and all these details about their economy, we're there, actually. The only reason that it's not so bad here is we're coasting on a surplus that was built up not just by the baby boom generation's parents, our parents, in the 50s, but a tradition of wealth, of prosperity that has been built up over hundreds of years, where we have the infrastructure in place. I mean, it's going to take years for the roads to completely crumble. We've got electricity everywhere. Pretty much everybody has running water. And we've got homes that are already built. We've got more homes than people can afford to buy right now. But eventually it diminishes. And right now we're spending our great-grandchildren's patrimony. The money that they should have to operate with is already gone. No matter what happens, we're going to live a Cuba-like existence in the sense of diminished economic opportunities. And I believe we can take it around. But if you think about what we're fighting, it's not just kings. To use another analogy, under Batista, the reason he was making so much money was because he had sweetheart deals with major U.S. corporations that were crooked and with the mob, who was acting as a broker between the corporations, the Cuban government, the American government, and, of course, their own gambling and sex and drug interests. When Castro took over from the mob, he adopted their techniques. He did exactly what the Cosa Nostra did, which is keep everybody quiet, keep them all in line, anybody steps out of line, and you end them. And you don't just do it quietly, you do it in a way that sends a message. And they had absolutely no compunction about harming someone's family either. So anyway, those are just a few points I wanted to make. This conversation is very interesting. I'm learning a lot.
Evelyn. I really appreciate what you said. I really do believe that the Castro brothers were really ideological Marxists. He had studied Marxism and was absolutely committed to the revolution. And, of course, if you read Marx and Engels, you will see that they said forming a dictatorship is just kind of a passing way. Eventually, all of this will come about and everybody will be equal. We will all be sharing the wealth. And this is one thing that I see with our local or our last president or current president is he asked, hey, don't you believe in sharing the wealth? And Castro said, we will share the wealth. So this is just an observation that we saw there.
But that makes it a zero-sum game. And if you think about, all right, I live in the mountains of Pennsylvania. You live in Florida. 100 years ago, there was a little bit here and there was a little bit there. 200 years ago, it was very sparsely populated with Native Americans. There was basically no infrastructure. There was very little going on, very few people, no roads, no electricity, no water, no houses, no industry, no railroads, no nothing but the woods, or in your case, I guess, swamps and beaches in Florida, which are very nice because it's cold up here right now.
it's cold right here. We're in Tallahassee.
Well, you grow an economy. And it's not government that does it. It's individuals who have freedom, who have, as your other caller mentioned, I'm sorry for not thinking of your name, but I didn't write that down, and I'm bad with names. Kelly. Sorry, Kelly. And it's because of a motivation, whether that selfish motivation is you want to help people because it makes you feel good, or you want to be important, or you want to be thought of as someone smart, or you want to make money. Nothing wrong with that, and it does help people. People develop things and, you know, create new things that where nothing was before. If you redistribute the wealth, you take away all motivation, and what you end up with is not only a dispirited people, but a diminishing pot that just it vanishes. It goes away. Get rid of every billionaire in the country today, every millionaire in the country today. Heck, get rid of anyone who's worth $100,000 or more. Just take everything they've got and redistribute it. You're not going to be able to pay the national debt alone for more than 3 months. And if you gave it to people instead of the government, which, you know, they're not going to do that. They have to take their cut. Everyone's going to get to live for about a year, year and a half. Someone did the math on this, and it checked out. I'm not a real math guy, but I got my calculator out, and when I found that link online, and that's it. And then who's going to create more? People are just going to sit there and wallow. The veneer of civilization is unfortunately very thin, as has been shown so many times in history. If you look at what happens when Rome fell, or any other great civilization, or when barbarian invasions like the Mongols swept across Asia and Central Asia all the way up to the gates of Europe, when you look at what happened in World War II, you look at what happens in some of these progressive-run cities today, the veneer of civilization disappears mm-hmm. in a generation. And I don't want to see that. I have a daughter, and I have, I used to coach as a whole generation of kids. I'm 52, who I would love to see them have the opportunity. These are great young Americans, and they've got nothing to look forward to. There's no jobs. Education is a sham. They've got no chance.
Could I just interrupt you one second to say this? Natalie and I were talking about this. In the 1950s, when the Cuban people were free, there was a lot of graft in their government, yes. But when they were free, do you think that they ever thought that this would happen to their country? Because whenever this brilliant, smart, articulate, charismatic Castro started telling about how the changes that he was going to bring in, they fell for it too. And a lot of the professional people were there welcoming him when he came in triumphantly.
Sounds familiar.
Well, that's the danger. That's the danger, which is that if most people who are suited for positions of high leadership in terms of skills and abilities don't necessarily have the depth of character that's required of a statesman. There are very few Churchills or Lincolns, if you want to go to that level. And if you want to go to the highest possible level, how many George Washingtons have ever existed? Ever. How many Mother Teresas have been able to have passing through their hands and never take one thin dime? How many? Which is why we have the Constitution, which is why if we only followed it, we would be limiting the power of these people, so that they can't get it beyond a certain point. Look, I'm a trustworthy fellow, but if you gave me that kind of power, I would only hope that I would behave correctly. No one knows until they get there, and unfortunately, many of the people who are on that path towards power, they compromise and sell their soul long before they ever get to a point where they can be effective to do good, and when they get to that point, all they do is evil.
Well, I want to bring you back in, Kelly, and chime in on anything or make any comments on any of what you heard here, and then we'll bring Cindy in, who's on the line. So go ahead, Kelly, and then we'll bring in Cindy, and then we'll go from there.
Yep. All right. Well, first of all, wow. I love this writer. Very eloquent. I'm really glad these ladies are here. I'm just, like, even more like, wow. There are some principles in life that are fundamental. Fundamental to society, fundamental to government and prosperity. It's real simple. Am I going to be rewarded for my work? If I am rewarded for my work, I will be greatly motivated. If I am not rewarded for my work, I get very discouraged. And, you know, I've had clients, oh boy, you know, a client owed me $900. She walks in today with $100. Gee. You know, that's a little discouraging. Client owed me $12,000, didn't pay, wife walked away, you know. It gets hard to continue when you're not rewarded for your work. I mean, oh, sure, you know, I made, what, $500 on paper today, but am I going to get paid? Well, this client, yeah, I am, so I jump for him. Some clients, it's been right up front, you know, I don't know if I want to do this for you because I don't think I'm going to get paid. When you have a government system that takes what you work for, you have robbed the people of motivation. When you eliminate motivation, the whole country ends up poor. And obviously that's what Cuba is about. And so I'm glad for these ladies to explain more of this to us. But now I want to go into the benefits. The benefits of socialism. Yes, there are benefits. You know, Brazil is a South American country, and the family's not so good, and, you know, men sleep around all the time. That's what this Brazilian that moved up here, she's a really good woman, but, you know, just disgusted with men in Brazil. So I was kind of thinking, man, maybe the family's not so good, but it is. So that's one good benefit of socialism. The next benefit of socialism is people are very healthy. Oh, my gosh, I mean, you got to go to work, okay, if you want to go to work. You get off the bus and you walk a mile or two. I mean, you get your exercise every day. So, and you eat natural foods. You know, of course, corporations won't have their power to implement GMO food. So it's pretty natural food as well as walking miles from the bus. So, hey, that's another benefit of socialism. The third benefit is, well, it's explained by Stalin. He murdered 20, 30, 50 million people. After that, there's plenty of food and housing to go around. So, look, socialism does have its benefits.
You're right with sarcasm there, Kelly, as we have grown to like love and expect from you on stage.
Well, I have to explain to these ladies that sometimes I use sarcasm and stories, allegories, to get my point across to... You know, it's like, what a joke. Socialism, how long has it lasted in the world, in the history of the world? Well, Stalin lasted, what, oh, that's 69 years, and people had enough, and then they rebelled. So, there's nations of the world. The Hebrews lasted 600 years. Okay, the British, Magna Carta, where the law was above the king, has lasted 900 years. Our country, Constitution, 200 years. I mean, like, you know, socialism, what, 69 years? Because they violate the fundamental principle that people aren't going to be rewarded for their work, then why try?
Mm-hmm. And it's about the bottom of the hour here into the second hour of the show. And so we will go into extended period. And what extended period is for the new folks is the show is live from 10 p.m. to midnight Eastern Time. And then at the stroke of midnight Eastern Time, the live portion of the show basically shuts everyone off. But we do have about an hour afterwards of extended period where those who call in at 347-945-7428 can still listen to the extended version of the show as well as chime in. So we just wanted to let folks know. We got about a half an hour left of the live portion of the show before we go into
the
extended period.
Hey, Robert, we had a point that we wanted to make about that our callers might be interested in, and Natalie wants to discuss about elections. Is that okay?
Oh yeah, certainly. And I also want to. We've got you know still a total time of an hour and a half to be able to get everything out, so we can have it on the archive as well. It's just a half an hour worth of the live time. But I also want to talk about a separate discussion we have where you told me about your trip to Colombia, and I want to hear more about the trip. And what we discussed there off the air, you know, in our conversations. But yes, I definitely want to go ahead and have her tell us that, and then I will bring in you, Cindy. Thank you very much, Cindy, for holding. We'll have Natalie have her comments in, and I'll bring you in. Go ahead, Natalie.
I want to talk a little bit about the elections. In Cuba, they say they have free elections. That's real interesting. But this is how they do it. They have what they call community organizers. And I think we know about that term, community organizers. And in each community, they have a community organizer, and they have what they call a community board. It's actually just like a board, not a billboard, but a board. And what they do is they don't have on their state TV, like the United States, they don't have advertisements about their candidates. And they use the United States as an example because they'll say, you know, we don't have this on our TV. And you know how awful that is. And, of course, the Americans are like, yeah, I get so sick of those advertisements. They're nothing but lies anyway. She said, well, we don't have that. This is what we do in Cuba. We take a bio, we have a bio and the platform of each candidate. And we place that bio and platform of each individual candidate on those community boards. And then, of course, the Americans are like, gosh, that's not a bad idea. Maybe we ought to do that. Of course. I raised my hand and I asked her, I said, who writes those bios and platforms? And she said, well, of course, the state does. So if the state is wanting a certain particular candidate, a communist candidate, of course, if a state is wanting that, they're going to write it in a way that's going to be most appealing to Cubans. That's how they conduct their elections, which I thought was just very interesting. I'd really hate to go in that direction.
It kind of sounds like the media's plays a big part in that and what we see today. But at this time, I did want to bring Cindy in. I know she's got some questions and comments. Thank you very much. And she's
one
of our loyal panelists here on the show as well. Thank you very much. And I also want to have a special thank you out to Arlene, who's posted and shared the show as well there on Facebook. So if you're out there listening, Arlene, as I know either here live or on the archives you are, I want to say a special thank you for you as well. So go ahead, Cindy.
Hi there. How are you ladies doing and you gentlemen?
Oh, we're great.
Well, it's been really, really good hearing you. And so nice to hear from people who've been there. I've been to one communist nation, China, and I find it very difficult to explain to people what I saw there. Nobody can really understand it unless they actually visit a communist nation, what actually happens, because it's like you said, they're very careful about what media puts out and what they are portrayed as. And they watch you very closely while you're there. It's kind of and the people they're just so much different from what you meet. You know, the people that you meet through your tourism or your activity or whatever it is you're doing there. You know, they'll give you interpreters and people to lead you around, tour guides and stuff like that. But you don't get to see the Joe Smith, the John Smith person who just, you know, is living his daily life. You don't get to see much of that. So when you do, it's quite an eye-opener. But anyway, I have a question. In Cuba, I mean, here in the United States, I mean, everybody knows that when a communist nation, when communist leaders want to take over a nation and change it into a communist country, they have to get rid of the middle class, so they have to basically annihilate the economy so that the middle class dies. Here in the United States, we've had such a strong middle class. They're having a bit of trouble doing that. They're having to spend trillions of dollars on bank bailouts, and now we've got an insurance bailout of a company that makes so much money, it's ridiculous anyway. Don't understand why we're bailing out insurance companies, but anyway, we're doing all these bailouts to try to kill our economy and to kill our middle class. Did the Cubans have that kind of an economy before Castro began his takeover? Did he have to do something like that to get rid of the middle class in order to bring the people down to that level?
You know, Cuba had, this is Natalie, Cuba had a very thriving economy before the revolution. And yes, they definitely had a middle class. But, you know, what Castro did when he came in, he got rid of them. He got rid of it. He took immediately, he went in and took the money. If you had money in the bank, it is now the state's. If you had money in your house and you didn't give it to the state, then you were arrested. So that was their way of getting rid of the middle class, and that's exactly what they did. They left as soon as they can get out with three different changes of clothes, and that's it, without any professional papers or anything. So that is how they got rid of the middle class in Cuba.
Yes, they didn't have like a constitution that protected them like we do. So it's like our president's having to make an end run around our constitution to take our money, and so he's using his power, his executive power, to do all these bailouts and stuff. So I was just wondering how the communists went about doing it. I guess it's amazing that the communist people, I mean, that the people of Cuba allowed that.
The ones that had any motivation or get up and go left. They saw what was going on. And so they took off and went to various places. I mean, just thousands of professional middle class, as you're calling them, and wealthy people left because they saw what was happening to their country. They didn't want to be killed, so they went someplace else.
But in America, where could we go? There is no place to go. And if you'll recall, in the 1920s, Stalin was having a problem with middle class, what he called kulaks. He called them peasants, but what they were was small farmers and businessmen in the Ukraine. And he simply engineered a famine. This breadbasket of the Soviet Union, of Russia, of Eastern Europe, which was like Canada or the Midwest. It grew tons and tons of grain and vegetables. They just simply confiscated everything and refused to let anyone sow any seeds and wouldn't distribute it. 20 million people died in 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
So where are we going to go? And hearkening back to communist or whatever you want to call them in Russia, you mentioned elections. I have a suspicion, and no matter what Jimmy Carter might say with his so-called Independent Election Commission that certified the Cuban elections as being free and fair, I'm sure he would say that about any dictator. You recall what Lenin said about voting. It's not who votes that counts. It's who counts the votes. And I'm absolutely certain
that
the government over there is who counts them.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, when the communists took over there, and they have no care about who dies or who lives, who dies. In fact, they want to reduce the population so that they can, you know, take care of the people a little bit better. Do you see an actual assault on our lives coming here in the United States?
Well, I'll tell you what. I sure hope not. And my own view is that violence is, as Isaac Asimov, the great writer, said, the last refuge of the incompetent. However, our Second Amendment, I believe, is the only thing that is preventing a complete takeover by statists, by progressives, by whatever you want to call it. The fact that there are 100 million Americans with 300 million guns is the reason why they don't actually use those unconstitutional provisions of the National Defense Authorization Act and other more recent developments that they've made legal. They're not constitutional. Obama can sign something with a pen, but he's got to enforce it. And he's getting a lot of blowback from patriots and including a lot of people on the left who are returning to their classical liberal roots and saying, don't tread on me. I want to do what I want to do. Even if others think it's strange, the government has no right to bother me. Would it ever come to that? Some of the people that surround Obama, including Bill Ayers, as part of the Weather Underground, they were infiltrated by an FBI informant back in the early 70s. And there are recorded conversations, which I have heard, they're available online, where these Weather Underground types who are now educators and prominent progressive leaders, and some of them in the administration as advisors, were discussing how that they were going to eliminate those they couldn't convince, and that it really wasn't that big a problem because with a massive population, if you got rid of 30 million people, you still have 270, and as Kelly mentioned, hey, less people to have to share what you've got left.
Right.
Would it come to it? It can't come to it if we keep our guns. It can't come to it if we use that power to keep our freedom of speech and religion, and if we insist on our Fourth Amendment rights for search and seizure and our Fifth Amendment rights for due process and our Tenth Amendment rights for states to make their own decisions and be the laboratories of democracy. But it can come to that very, very easily if one person or one small group of people who are just nuts manage to seize those the levers of control. I mentioned Saddam Hussein earlier. There's a video that's also available online, and they've played it on television before, of his first takeover, his first meeting of the Ba'ath Party Congress. He gathered them all together. And one by one, he had people who had given him any kind of hard time removed from the room and shot right outside the room. And, that was the beginning of a reign of tyranny that saw gassing of innocents, that saw massacres, that saw abuses institutionalized to a point where it was as if a thug, as if Kaiser Sose, some fictional character, was actually running a country. And it happened under Idi Amin, and it happened under Stalin, and it happened under Hitler. So can it happen? You bet it can happen. And all that's required for it to happen is all the levers of power being concentrated in the hands of one man or one small group of men. And we're heading straight down that path, and we're gaining speed. So I'm worried.
Well, I am too, because as you were saying, the U.S. is the last place of safety. We're the last bastion of any kind of sanity, mm-hmm. as far as we're the last great hope. Because once we have gone down that route to communism, and we're taken over by some small oligarchy, a one world order ruled by an oligarchy. When all that is gone, all the reforms that were made in China and Russia recently to help their people do a little bit better, all the things that England, France, Germany, whatever those people are able to do to keep from sliding from socialism straight into communism, all those walls will come down, and we will be the type of communism that Russia was and China was in the beginning, what Cuba is now.
You know that one world order that you mentioned, and Reagan said we're the last best hope of mankind. But the one world order is a temporary measure among tyrants. If you look at the days of Al Capone, if you ever watched The Untouchables on television or saw the movie, the mobs worked together to gain control of the entire system. But their egos, the leaders, did not end once they got control. They didn't stay peaceful. They continued to massacre each other. In fact, once they had the police force and the courthouse and everything else under their thumb, they pretty much went wild with it. What has happened in the past is there was the Molotov-Ribbentrop pact between Germany, Nazi Germany, and Soviet Russia. There were pacts between Italy under Mussolini and Tojo. I mean, in Japan, they all pretended to work together, acted to work together. In fact, Germany and Russia decided, yeah, you know, we'll split Poland up. It's fine. We don't need a buffer state. But it only lasted a short time, and what ends up happening is the ordinary person is then cannon fodder for a mm-hmm. fight among tyrants. I don't think China is going, and the United States, if they're both being run by totalitarian regimes, are going to be friends. I just don't think so. One is going to want to what the other has.
Well, right, I think now, it would start out that way. I think it would start out that way. As a one world order, and then because of the fighting over power, I think it would descend into the fragments. You're right about that.
And ladies and gentlemen, I do want to bring it over to our guests here tonight, to Natalie and Evelyn, and then the mic's yours, so to speak, and then we'll bring in Harriet, who was the one who introduced me and gave me the information tonight. So thank you, Harriet, again, for bringing my attention about these two ladies tonight to bring them here on the show. I appreciate it. And so we'll give them the mic, and then we'll open up your mic, Harriet, so that you can ask some questions yourself. Go ahead, Evelyn and Natalie.
Okay, you had asked me about Colombia, my trip to it, and I wanted to make a statement, and some of you may be aware of it, others probably are not. Colombia really was a marvelous, it's really a marvelous country, and we know that we have heard all of these stories about drugs and the guerrillas that were taking over. But in 2002, a president was elected, and we talked about how one person could make a real impact. They had a president who was elected whose name was Uribe, and he decided, hey, we're going to get into this corruption, we're going to get rid of this corruption, we're going to get rid of the guerrillas, we're going to get rid of all of these drug trafficking. We are starting a major war on this. So he strengthened his army, he built up his army with, by the way, the help of the United States, who did give him information, more training of his army. And he reduced this guerrilla army, which were the communists that were planning to take over. Actually, they started out as communists, you know, being for the people and all of this bit, but really they were just thugs that were doing the drug trafficking and everything. And Uribe reduced this guerrilla force from 30,000 to about 8,000. That is what they have now. And it is really just an amazing thing. The people there are basking in their freedom. Next door, there is a country called Venezuela. And this is a very different situation. The President Chavez died. But in his place, there is one that is even worse. His name is Maduro. And Maduro was an uneducated truck driver who has brought in Raul Castro to build up his army and even to serve in his army. They are dedicated to going into countries that are having difficulty. Example, Ecuador, Bolivia, Brazil, Argentina, any of these countries that are having some turmoil, they are dedicated to going and taking it over. Colombia has been the thorn in Venezuela's shoe. And this was told to us by all four of our guides that took us around to different parts of Colombia. So I really do feel that most people in the United States have absolutely no concept that we do have a friend in Colombia, and it's about the only friend that we do have in South America.
Well, if anyone else would like to chime in that before, then I do want to bring in Harriet. And so, since Harriet's got a question, thank you very much, Harriet, for calling in. How are you?
Yes, fine. Thank you. And Evelyn and Natalie, I'm so delighted that we have you online tonight. I'm just delighted. I'm from Marion County as well. Let's go from here now. There's been some events that have occurred in our country within the last week that has been of interest to me. But I'm going to put this on hold for a moment because I did hear your PowerPoint in Ocala at the GOP meeting where I was so impressed. And one thing I would like you to mention, if you don't mind, is that what is the reason for the Castro government to teach reading to our children in school, to their children in school, which was very impressive, related to the voting system in Cuba?
Right. When Castro came in, one of the first thing he did, and he bragged about how he was going to get rid of illiteracy and teach everybody to read. Well, you know, Cuba was a very educated country in the first place. A lot of professionals in Cuba, really good education system before the revolution. But that's what he said he was going to do, and so he did it. But the guy who took us around told us one of the reasons why they really wanted to make sure that everybody could read in Cuba was so that they would have free elections and that they would be able to read the board. You know, I talked about how they kind of handled their elections in Cuba, where they actually have a bio and a platform for each candidate, and then the person will make make their decision on their candidate. Well, one of the reasons why they wanted to teach them to read was so that they could read their candidate bios and platform, and then, of course, put their vote in. So that was one of the things she said, not really to the whole group. I had an opportunity to really befriend her and talk to her a little bit more about it, and as she was asking me about questions about certain high-ranking officials in the United States as well. But that's one of the things she said, the one reason why they wanted them to read so they can read the bios and platforms for the candidates.
I just thought that was interesting, and thank you for that. Now, one good thing I think that came out of some of the news for the week is that True the Vote organization has won a huge court case in Ohio, and Ohio now must adhere to 9 mandates of free and fair elections. If not, then they get sanctioned. And I thought that was marvelous, and I just hope that that continues throughout the country, because as we know, how we get not who we really would want to run our country, because elections are controlled and they're not honest, as we know. So I'm hoping that this will be the start of getting our country back to having free and fair elections, because we really need to concentrate on 2014 ahead of 2016 elections so that we can get a stable and a Congress who will be able to support whoever will be president. Now, other things that have come out that I have concerned with tying in with your topic of are we going to meet Cuba? Are we going to slide into Cuba? Two things I'm very, very concerned about is that the president's speech today about taking the pen and paper in hand and writing our laws and disregarding our Congress, to me, that tells us that our Constitution is no longer effective, and that is a big, big worry, I think, for the nation. The other thing is yesterday I heard on video where Mark Levin was talking about now the president has created a coup, so we're building coups in our country. The thing that is most concerned to me is how quickly and how close are we sliding into Cuba? How quickly and how close are we into a complete, almost a complete changeover of our country at this point from freedom to socialism?
Harriet, I just want to say two things real quickly.
Yes.
This is Dan. First of all, you're wonderful. I've been following you in the last week on Facebook and the things you're doing, and I'm really pleased to associate with you, and I hope we meet. The other thing you mentioned is our Constitution as not being effective and not being in effect. It's a piece of parchment. It's
right.
A bunch of ideas. It's the American people who are responsible, and we have allowed ourselves to fall asleep. Had we simply gotten rid of a small percentage of incumbents every single election cycle, just a few, that would have sent a message and kept them on their toes, but we kept reelecting the same people, and we keep doing it today. However, I want you to take a little bit of heart. I'm in Pennsylvania, and that's where most of my contacts are in this area, but I have a growing list of people that I'm working with across the entire country. We have people who are now entering public life, entering public service, running for county committees, running for the Republican Party, a few in the Democrat Party, people who are running for office, small office through with the help of groups like American Majority and the Precinct Project, and True the Vote, which is nonpartisan, is a wonderful group as well. We have people who are speaking. I never did any of this stuff until about a year and a half ago. I didn't want to. I still don't really enjoy it. I'm good at it, so I do it because it's got to get done. And we've got people doing all kinds of things that they'd rather not have to do. I'm sure this isn't the thing that is the encompassing obsession of your life, but it's something that has to be done if you want your kids, your grandkids, other people's kids and grandkids to have a future. So take heart. And everybody, if you can make it to Washington on May the 16th, we want 10 million people there. And the bottom line, the one thing that is absolutely what we all agree with is simply the Constitution, that we want it back. Those ideas are still good. The paper still exists. I have a copy. I'm sure you all do. It's a very short 19-page little pamphlet. And we want it back. We don't want these people to rule in our name anymore and ignore the oath that they took to defend a piece of paper that limits the power from abuse. And if we don't get it back, there's going to be hell to pay.
Dan, I think
Real quick, everyone. I hate to interrupt, but I do see that we only have about 6 minutes left of the live version here on Bard's Logic Political Talk, and we will be going into the extended version. But first, I want to thank everyone who came tonight listening to us live, but who cannot stay for the extended version. But if you'd like to hear us for going into that period, you could call us here at 347-945-7428. Again, that's 347-945-7428. If you just like to listen to the extended version, because if you don't call in about next 6 minutes, you will not be able to hear that. but you would also be able to hear the archive available immediately after the show. And, of course, if you'd like to chime in as well, just push the 1 on the number dial. Let me know. But if you are a Facebook user, you could send me a message there or a message in the chat here on Blog Talk Radio to let me know that you want to chime in to the show. So for those who cannot today, I want to thank you again for coming in tonight. We look forward to you coming next week. And next week we will be promoting the Twitter events on the Patriot Journalist Network. And check it out by going to www.patriotjournalist.com, where they will be having a Twitter event all day on the 22nd. The tweet went out all day, but between 1 p.m. and 11 p.m., and the Twitter event will be the Pray to End Abortion event. So definitely check that out at thepatriotjournalist.com. And we'll be promoting that on the show next week. The abortion topic will be what we'll be discussing. We'll also be discussing a book by Scott Klusendorf, which is called The Case for Life. And so we look forward to that show and inviting everyone to come back to talk about that all-important discussion. So thank you very much, everyone, and we will bring it back to you, ladies and gentlemen. Sorry for interrupting, but I definitely want to get that out before the end of the live portion expired. So I heard you, Harriet, if you want to finish your comments, and then we'll bring it back over to the ladies,
yes.
And then I'd like to bring Kelly back in.
Yes. I want to say that, Dan, I am involved in many things that I don't want to discuss online. I'm very active in this range. So the more active I become, the more I study, the more I research, the more I listen to the Blog Talk Radio shows. We have a wonderful host on Sunday evening, and that show we learn a lot from. We learn a lot. I learn from everything. So I have questions, and I'm putting thoughts together. But what I'm saying is, I had not known of any march or meeting in Washington that has been so far effective in obtaining the goal that they started out to. Even the truckers had not accomplished the goal that they went to Washington for, and the people before that had different conferences and different walks and marches. It has not worked out. People have their heads in the sand. They don't want to work. They don't. They somehow want to talk, but they want someone else to do the work. And that is what I'm finding out. Not everybody, but the people that we can use, more people to help, more people to work, more people to get to call, to fax, to speak out. Risk. Take a risk. I take all kind of risk, and sometimes I get hit over the head, but I just get right back up and I go on with my agenda, and I take this very seriously.
Thank you, Harriet. I'm going to be going in a moment. I just wanted to leave Harriet with one thought and the rest of you. We need only what we have, which is all we will have. 3% of the United States population is 9 million people. We have 9 million people who are firmly committed to the Constitution. If each one of those persons has 10 people who follow the natural leadership that they provide, even if it's only temporarily, even if it's only a question of doing a few tasks, we win. We can win. And the vast majority of the people always sit it out, always are confused, always don't know or don't want to go along, do what's required, or they believe the BS. People believe what they want to hear. Not everybody, though, and not you and not me and not your listeners. I know a lot of you feel alone. A lot of you feel like you're isolated and there's so few. But I talk to people everywhere. I talk to people. You can tell I like to talk. And all walks of life. And when I get away from political labels and press labels, and I get away from isms, anarchy, totalitarianism, communism, and I just talk about what people really want in their lives, and I listen to what they have to say, the vast majority of people will follow us. And we do need more leaders. And we, the people on this show and the people that you're dealing with on Facebook and in rallies and in committees and in political action things and patriot groups, we're their leaders. And it's not because we want power or we want to lead. It's because somebody
no.
has to take a step. So anyway, I'd like to thank everybody tonight very much. And the morning, 6 a.m., comes very early.
Yeah.
So I appreciate it. I am on Facebook, Harriet and Bob.
I know we're friends. Yeah, I know we're friends.
And
Dan,
please,
what's your name again? That I can find on Facebook.
Dan Gray, G-R-A-Y. And anybody out there, we need to network a lot better. There's some
yeah.
few things like Harriet that I will not share on an NSA-based computer system. But most of this stuff, they already know, and I'm not afraid of getting higher up on their enemies list. I look upon it as a mark of honor. So,
wow.
Anyway, good night, everybody. Thank you.
Good night, Dan.
Thank you very much, Dan.
Honored to talk
to
you,
Dan. Again. You take care.
Okay.
Well, I guess it's
back
to our
great to have Dan on.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Dan, for coming to the show. We are in our extended version, so... So for those who are on the line, thank you very much for staying. Try not to get disconnected because, unfortunately, once folks get disconnected, now they cannot call back in. So I do want to bring the mics back over to our guests tonight. So Natalie and Evelyn, whatever you guys want to chime in on or answer more questions or elaborate on anything, go ahead. You have the floor.
I would just like to say, and I think this sums up everything that you guys have talked about tonight, that the real message that I feel that we need to take with us is this, that eternal vigilance is the price of freedom. And you all have alluded to the fact that we need to be completely cautious and aware and help individuals realize this, because it is only when we are consistently watching what is happening, like what is happening in Cuba, what is happening in Venezuela, what is happening in South America, and in some of these other countries too, that will we truly be free. So this is a message that I would like to leave with you.
Do we miss something?
No, no, we're here. We're just
okay. No, okay. Go ahead. I just was quiet all of a sudden. I was not.
I did ask, you know, if you have a question about Cuba and our experience that we had there, we'll be delighted to answer it. So if you can ask a question, that will be delightful. You know, I will ask a little. I'll give a little quiz here. When we were in Cuba, we had an opportunity, like I said, to talk to the tour director a little bit more beyond what she was telling everybody in our group. And she asked me about one particular leader in the United States. And she was asking me about this person because Cuba fears this person the most. So I'm going to ask you, who do you think Cubans fear the most? And I'm going to give
you
three choices.
About the people, you're talking about the people or the government of Cuba?
The government of Cuba.
Fears.
Yes, and I'll give you three choices. One would be maybe Congressman Mario Diaz-Balart, who has a family relationship with Castro, but is very anti-Castro. Former Governor Jeb Bush or U.S. Senator Marco Rubio? Anybody have any guess?
I would say Ted Cruz. That would
be my
guess.
Remember, we were there in February before Ted Cruz arrived in the scene very much. I'm sure Ted Cruz is probably high on that list.
Right, I'm sure he is, too.
Yeah, uh-huh. But the answer is Marco Rubio.
Really?
What was that?
Yes, the answer is Marco Rubio.
Guess.
The
The Cuban government fears Marco Rubio. She said almost every day there's some report that's very negative about Marco Rubio, and she wanted to know, since I was from Florida, she wanted to know more about Marco Rubio, what he was like, what the Americans feel about him, and so on. And I said, why are you so interested in Marco Rubio? And she said, because he is the guy that the state fears the most. They think he is going to change all of what Obama is doing now, and that is opening tourism up, allowing all of those person-to-person education visas, allowing Americans to come down to Cuba and to listen to that propaganda. And they fear that he is going to stop all that and stop a lot of the major tourism in Cuba.
I wonder what makes them think that.
Yeah, do you have any, that's a good question. What makes them think that that's going to happen?
It's just power, and the fact that he's Cuban. His family came from Cuba. They were very poor. I think his father was a bartender, wasn't he? Very poor family, even in Miami, but worked themselves, and of course, Marco. Becoming I think he was a county commissioner, then became a member of the Florida House of Representatives and the youngest speaker at that time ever in the Florida House, and then, of course, ran against Charlie Crist and won the U.S. Senate race. But that's, I think it's a lot of it's because he is Cuban. They just hear a lot about him down there, and they fear him. Now, that was back in February, and your caller's right. It could be Ted Cruz now, just because the fact that Ted Cruz has been getting a lot of press, and I'm sure they're probably after him as well.
Could I say just about our guide? This guide was very personable. She spoke English very well. She was very friendly. She was very helpful. For example, I needed a covering to bring my painting that I bought back on the plane. And I said, do you have any kind of plastic bag? And she said, plastic bags in Cuba are just very rare. But the next day she came with a plastic bag and gave it to us to bring our paintings back in. But she was very charming, very likable, and this is the type of person that appeals to American tourists. Some of them were inviting her to come back, but she did say to us that she, her family, her mother especially, was very dedicated to the revolution, she called it, and she probably was too. But her grandfather had come to Miami. So that family was broken apart by Castro.
Mm-hmm. Well, I had a thought, and now I can't remember what I was going to say.
I want to bring I want to bring Kelly back into the conversation. I was to go ahead, Kelly. He might have muted his mic sometimes. Folks do that while they're listening. And I appreciate that because sometimes we'll get some like background noise or things of that nature. But Kelly, go ahead when you can or want to chime in. Just you can interrupt me or else that's fine. He might have to step away for a little bit. So Harriet, see, we still have you on the line. Is there anything you'd like to?
No,
I'm here.
Bring up? No,
is that Kelly?
Yeah, I'm right here.
All right, there we go. Great, glad you got back.
Yeah, you were talking about background noise, and I hear these wonderful guests, these ladies from Tallahassee that visited Cuba. I hear writer Dan Gray, and I hear Cynthia. And I'm like, wait a minute, there's background noise. Who's that guy that's running the show? Is Robert? Is that the background noise? All right.
Am I background noise? Is that it?
That is
typing, actually, to Mr. Dan Gray. We're discussing something. Go ahead.
Okay. All right. So, well, maybe I should make some points. You know, Dan had some positive thoughts. Others have had some positive thoughts. And I want to bring forward, if I may, one of the greatest positive thoughts that I can really think of. It's called an idea. What is harder to eradicate than a virus? An idea. And the idea of liberty as presented in the Constitution, proposed for posterity, one of the greatest ideas we have is that we can be rewarded for our work, that we can be free. Yes, we need the government, but government, you will be held to account. There is no king, no president above the law. The law or the Constitution is above you. We have gone through generations of this, you know, due process, right to remain silent, except I'm not very good at it. We have phenomenal ideas of liberty and posterity and free will that has not just gone into our minds. It's not just gone into our souls. It's gone into the genetics of the genetics of our being. And the right to bear arms is the ultimate exercise to enforce that right. And so we have a system that is, it's a tough nut to crack. If I could summarize and say, look, the American people are a tough nut to crack because we have these ideals in our genetics. And there is an awful lot of hope. So hopefully we can unify enough to overcome the swear, beep, beep going on in our country. And I think we're gonna prevail, but it does take a lot of work.
Definitely. And one thing we're all aware of as well is that, you know, we need just for people to rise up, and I don't mean to rise up in violence or anything of that nature, but I mean actually rise up and get involved in ways that, you know, we haven't in a very, very long time. I mean, we really need to be active en masse, because that's what it's going to take anymore. I mean, even more so than what we've seen, you know, regardless of if you're on the right or left, whether it's the Occupy Wall Street movement that, you know, we've seen, or the Tea Party movement. I mean, it's going to have to be something greater than that. And I even would contend, and you guys can make comment on this, is that, you know, and I call this, you know, Bard's logic, the grassroots, we the people show, because I welcome moderates and I welcome liberals on the side if we can be in agreement on it's about we the people, you know, and not the government, you know, taking over, regardless of your ideology, regardless of your party. You know, the government, and I would even contend, also in league with the corporatists, are taking over, in which they are becoming the new aristocracy. And where is that leaving, you know, the we, the people? And I think that's going to affect all of us, regardless the set of, you know, religion or ideology or party or things of that nature. So I think it's important for all of us to get together, at least in that common cause. We'll have our differences, of course. Ideologically, we'll have our differences. But those kind of things that can be worked out later, but we need to work together now when this just is so important for us not to slide into. And I think, you know, I don't think all liberals would say would be communists per se, or have the, you know, totalitarianism. I just think it's just, you know, different views that they have. But we do share, I think we do and can share in this, you know, when it comes to what the government is doing to we the people.
Could I just jump in and say one thing?
I don't know
if you saw, this is following the thought that some other people had mentioned about bearing arms. I don't know if you saw the clip on the police chief of Detroit, who was encouraging just the citizens of Detroit and some of these areas to arm themselves, because he said that the criminals feared much more the people that had the arms more than they did the police there. They did not trust the police. but they would fear if they thought or knew that someone had a gun that they would not be and go into their homes. I just thought that was an interesting, because you don't think police chiefs in Detroit thinking like that.
Well, Evelyn, is that, I'm assuming that's Evelyn.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, you're telling me that you don't believe in victim disarmament?
Victim disarmament. I believe that individuals have a right to protect themselves and their property from individuals who would be coming into their particular home or who would accost them. Yes, I do believe.
That's a name for those who want gun control. They are advocating victim disarmament. Yes. Let's disarm the victims so we have a wonderful world and I don't care about your personal life and you need to get raped or your kids get murdered. I don't care, you know. I just everybody's got to be safe because we just get the guns and all the criminals will have them. But, you know, victim disarmament is a good idea. That's what those who want to oppose the Second Amendment are really saying.
And you see this every time you have a shooting. How it in a school especially. We just get rid of the guns.
We would be rid
of this. But a lot of these individuals have some very serious mental problems. And I know, Natalie and I have talked about our state is probably the rock bottom state in assisting individuals or spotting individuals who need services for mental health. We're 49th in Florida. We look at that. It's not taking the guns away, because if they take guns from the good people, only the criminals will have guns, like they do in Cuba. Not the criminals, but the, quote, people that are protecting the others.
Right. You know, one thing that drives me nuts, and you mentioned the school real quick, Kelly, and you mentioned the school. It just drives me nuts because as when you go to, you know, the school and they have that sign in there, you know, no one can bring, you know, guns in or whatever the sign says, something like that. It's unlawful to carry firearms, I mean, into this building. You know, someone who wants to do harm to children and they see that sign, you're probably just to tell them, hey, you can come in here with a gun without impunity, because there's no one really here to stop you, because the folks who, you know, are here who could actually protect the children, you know, from somebody coming in and shooting people instead of waiting for the police, they can't do anything themselves because they're not allowed to bring a gun to school. I think that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. Now, of course, you can't have the children in grade school or bring it, because really, Helton is a grade schooler, and they don't need a sign on a door to let a grade schooler know or even a high schooler know that you don't bring a gun to school. But for them to say this is a gun-free zone, that's not going to stop anybody. I think that, you know, if it was, you know, up to me, what I would like to see, where I would see done, is that you would have either the principal or the teachers go get licensed, okay, so that they can carry and operate a firearm, so that if anything like that ever happened again, that you have trained teachers who can have that gun and take out the person out there trying to, you know, do harm to those kids. That's what I think. I think those, you know, those children are under the protection of those teachers. What, you know, and it's unfortunately it's come to the point where you have these shootings and these kids' very lives need to be protected by these teachers. So it should be, in my opinion, the teachers or the principal or a mixture of both. Of course, they have to be trained in it, of course, so they can actually carry these firearms in the school, so that if anything like that happens, they can protect the children. You know, as well. I mean, I think it's ridiculous that they do that, especially in today's climate and all the things that we've seen happen with these school shootings. Okay, I'm off my soapbox. So sorry about Kelly. If you're gonna say something, I just wanted to get that out of my system, because that drives me nuts when I see that.
Where did soapbox come from?
Soapbox?
Yeah.
I don't know. You stand up on a soapbox on a corner or something,
like
pouting
or
whatever. Politicians
used to come, and they had to could get up above them if they had a crate or a box and they would turn it over, and they would get up and stand on that, and they could speak to the people. They didn't have television.
Right. And I'm short. I'm only 5 foot six, so I have to stand on a crate or a box.
Yeah. Well, here I want to throw out a couple questions for Evelyn. First of all, and we're talking about arms, weapons, knife. Knife can be used for cooking an awesome dinner or it can shed blood. A baseball bat can send a man to first base or the hospital. It's irrelevant what the weapon is. It's the person behind it. So I want to discuss with you a question, and I'll bet you I know what the answer is without doing the research. All right? This is fundamental. Fundamental, and I'll explain it because I'm going to go to Magna Carta. Oh, no, the Magna Carta guy. All right, so, well, yeah, it was a little important. In modern times, the first time that the charter was above the king. That's what our Constitution is, a charter above the king. All right, fundamental question here in your research. Did Cuba have any form of grand jury? And do you know what a grand jury is?
Sure, I know what it is. We assume, because we did not hear, they really have no judicial system as we would know a judicial system. I know that they will throw individuals in jail. For example, they have certain people that I think there was a guy who went down and they put him in jail as a spy. I'm sure they had no grand jury that indicted him. They just put him in. So the government themselves or the individuals that are in charge make the decisions as to who will be incarcerated and even who would be shot. So answer your question, I would say no.
And you remember the people don't have rights in Cuba. So it's not going to make a difference even if they said they're innocent or other people have said they're innocent. It doesn't matter. They just don't have the rights.
Right. Yeah, that's a horrifying end result of oppression. Anyway, all right, so I'm going to take you to Magna Carta, okay? Again, why is this important?
12/15.
Yes, June 15th, 12/15, get all invited to a big party at Runnymede, England, which, by the way, is a field. Runnymede, England, okay, Anglo-Saxon for a regular meeting in the meadow. That's what Runnymede is. All right, that's where the Magna Carta was signed. So next year, June 15th, you're all invited. I'm going to be there. I'm like, whatever it takes to get there. All right. In the Magna Carta, there was a phenomenal clause. It produced our right of petition, First Amendment right of petition, which, by the way, is not to the legislature or the courts. It is to a grand jury, originating in the Magna Carta. Okay, so you got a complaint. Who do you go to? Well, obviously the legislature isn't listening. Obviously the king isn't listening. Obviously the courts aren't listening and takes a whole bunch of money. So who do you go to? Oh, that's right, the grand jury. C-61, or clause, as Blackstone wrote, 1700s, brilliant lawyer, his essays on the laws of England. This is before the Declaration. He put in clauses, C-61, okay? C-61 for the Magna Carta. First sentence, the grand jury, you have the right to petition to it. The King of England was furious. King George, or Bad King George, says, or not George, John. We experienced Bad King George. They experienced Bad King John. And the barons of the north invaded London, kicked him out of town. He was so bad. This is the Revolutionary War before the Magna Carta was signed. It forced the Magna Carta to signature. King John was so bad, people at the London gates would say, yeah, come in, we're tired of him too. So the barons of the lords kicked him out of London, and then he was forced to sign the Magna Carta. Okay, you can be a king, but you're going to acknowledge our rights. And by the way, we have a system of accountability, C-61. It has helped England last over 900 years. In your studies of Cuba, I will bet you they did not have a grand jury system like we do in America, which has indicted those around the president, and Nixon had to resign. So those two things, Magna Carta, C-61, that's one, and number two, did Cuba have a grand jury? And I'll bet they did not.
I would concur with that because absolutely, in fact, in my looking at some of these countries, that they may have a constitution, but remember, they have no Bill of Rights. In fact, I was talking with some Australians about not having a Bill of Rights. English people do not have a Bill of Rights. They have a constitution. And they said they didn't need a Bill of Rights because it would confuse things.
Oh, gosh.
Go ahead, Kelly, and then I want to ask him about something. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, here's what's funny about our Bill of Rights, okay? The Constitution was passed without the Bill of Rights. And a bunch of states were saying, hey, wait, we need to put some things down in paper for posterity. We need to sing the call of the Bill of Rights for a session of Congress. Oh, hey, thanks for approving the Constitution, and, well, what about the Bill of Rights? Whoops, sorry about that, guys. We'll get that right out to you. And they did. They got the Bill of Rights out, and the state said, yeah, you think? So, just a little oversight by those, you know, that signed and got the Constitution together. But, you know, whoops, sorry about that, guys. Yeah, we'll get the Bill of Rights out to you. So, anyway, it's just a little historical humor. But the reality is we have it, and we have great case law that the judges keep saying, yeah, this is a good idea. Yeah, oh, my gosh, yeah. So our right of petition is to a grand jury, and that grand jury can turn around and investigate corrupt government officials, Governor Blagojevich of Illinois, county judges, federal judges, state judges, state legislatures, U.S. congressmen, I don't care. It's what's missing in so many countries that fall and fail and collapse and then are subject to socialism. It's just one of those things. And so I just kind of wanted to bring that to your attention. But I'm asking that in your research of Cuba, find out if they had that great system of accountability where everyday people, your friends and neighbors, get in a grand jury and say, you know what, I'm going to look at the government. I'm going to investigate the government. Oh, my gosh, you're out of office, dude. And I'll bet you'll find...
They would be shocked if they did.
If they did, they're missing.
Yeah.
But I'm talking,
they have them, but
right.
They're gone.
Right. It's absolutely missing. There's no question about it, okay? It's no question it's missing now. But during Batista, I'll bet you the Constitution set up for him and Batista, I'll bet they didn't have it.
No, because he had a coup, and he took over. When they have a coup, they just overthrow everything. So that is what happened with Batista. That's why he just assumed ultimate power, like you had mentioned on your dictator. So if they had one with a republic, which they probably did, he with a coup just overthrew it all. I think their first president was a guy whose name was Gerardo Machado.
I know there was Batista Mojado, but before him, the government they had, I'll bet they did not have it.
Yeah,
they didn't have
they
the right
not,
of petition.
And I don't know, but I think they did have a constitution because most republics do set up some constitution. It may not be anything like what we would think as a constitution.
The Weimar Republic had a constitution to get rid of trial by jury. And then, they fell. Russia had a constitution. They fell. China had a constitution. They fell. Cuba did have a constitution before Batista. They fell. But I'm asking you in your research, in the constitution, when it was thriving, when it was good, I bet they didn't have the right of petition nor a grand jury.
I don't know, but you're probably right on that one. I will defer to your wisdom on that one.
Yeah, I'm asking you to keep researching it and find this out. It's fundamental.
Yeah, we'll look. We'll look at it again. We have some sources.
Don't you?
That
I'm sorry. Go ahead. I thought you were done.
Go ahead, Cindy.
I was just going to ask Kelly. Kelly, don't you think that really our president has become bulletproof to our judicial system, though? I mean, look at all the lawsuits that have come up trying to stop him and curb him and everything that we've tried to do. Rand Paul's got one out now. There's like 20-something out there now. And it all just rolls off his back like water off a duck.
It doesn't matter what the law is when you have ultimate power.
Right.
Or you are you have deceived yourself to think you have ultimate power.
I would say that is the way it is.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone that I know would ever fall for his having ultimate power. He may think that he has, but he does not.
So you're saying the latter is more applicable than the former. You're saying that. He doesn't have ultimate power, but he has deceived himself into thinking he does.
Yes.
And, well, I don't know. I just think that if you look at what I think at this point he has all the power he wants. Whether he continues with that is going to be up to the people, whether they rise up against him, and that'll be interesting to see. Because if we rose up against him. As one big voice, one large, huge, 100 million person voice, he'd be stopped. But will America do that, or will America just sleep in the pews and sleep at the job and allow it to go on?
I think what Obama does is that he throws out all of these ideas and. People will criticize him and jump on him, and he is perceiving himself as having this power, and then he realizes that people are questioning him, and he just gives up and goes to something else. Because that's the way he just runs from one thing to the other.
You know, there's a person more dangerous than a flat-out liar. It is someone who is delusional, who has creative reality, who can create the reality they're trying to obtain, and they convince themselves so much that they become convincing of others to join in their game.
Have you ever looked at one of the precepts of communism? Now, I'm back to this again, that the end justifies the means, so that any way that you can convince the people, even if you have to lie or deceive them in any way, because your ultimate goal is that you are going to do all of these great, wonderful things that will equalize the wealth and will make it into just a utopian society. So when we look at this pragmatic outlook, the end justifies the means, that is one of their major precepts.
Rule for Radicals, Saul Alinsky. Yes. Yes.
It was also Marx and Engels in the Communist Manifesto in 1848.
Right. All right. At this point, I have to bring up the verdict. The verdict upon mankind. The verdict that still stands, though spoken 2,000 years ago. Are you ready for it? This is totally exposing the socialist agenda. Do whatever, lie, go behind back doors, make deals, and then come out. Well, sign the bill, and then we'll let you know what's in it. Really?
Yeah, that's the same thing,
okay.
Right.
Yeah. This is the verdict.
You are preaching to the choir.
Right. Well, have you heard the verdict? I'm sure you have. It's after the most loving statement ever made to the universe.
What was that? Yeah. We pass the bill, and then we find what was in it. Yeah,
right. Find out what's in it.
Okay, well, there's, John 3:16, loving, and then John 3:17, it starts in, 3:18, actually. This, then, is the verdict. Light has come into the world, but men hate the light because their deeds were evil. And we're afraid that their deeds would be exposed. But whoever does what is right comes into the light so that it may be seen clearly. What has been done through God. And Jesus even said, look, Pharisees, look, I've been out in the open every day. And you come and arrest me in the dark? What a difference.
I remember reading that.
Yeah, if you're in the light, you're doing what's right, it's natural, it makes sense, boom, you're out in the open, everything's cool. If you're trying to do something in the dark, socialist, communist, you're of evil. That's the bottom line.
The evil empire.
Yeah.
They know that what they're doing is evil. They know that people will die. They know that people will lose their fortunes. They know that people will end up in prison because of them. They know what they're doing, but they're so power hungry and so full of themselves that they just can't help themselves. They have that mentality that we know what's best for all the people.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to tell you what you should do with your life and your money and whatever.
Supposedly being an environmentalist and then flying, you know, all over the place in his corporate jet and having such huge mansions where probably leave much bigger carbon footprint than those that he's, touting against.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
His carbon footprint is ridiculous. Is the Bigfoot of carbon footprint.
Well, yeah, what I'm saying here is the first sign of evil is that they have to do it clandestinely. They have to scheme behind the scenes. They take people out in the back alley where no one's watching, and they have to kill them. They do things without it instantly. When they realize, I have to hide what I'm doing, they're committing evil. That's socialism.
Well, they think that they have to hide it because we don't know what's good for us, and they have to do it behind our backs, and then they can say, now see, we made the best decision for you. Now isn't your life wonderful?
Yeah, my life is real wonderful, but I'm pushing daisies, okay?
Now, see, this is where the end justifies the means, because we are going to have this utopian state where everybody is equal.
Right.
And because of that, whatever we have to do, if we have to get rid of those that resist us, and that is what Che Guevara, that is what Fidel sanctioned, because the end of this great utopian society justifies the means.
Well, it's absolutely justifiable.
Hold on a second, Kelly. But I'll add on to that is everyone will be equal except for those who rule us.
Right. Yes, right. But that is only temporary, according to Marx and Engels. And Das Kapital. That is only temporary. Those people,
no,
of course,
so far,
you know that's
not
the
true.
Way it works. That
well,
according
yeah, that's
to
not true.
Radical communism, that is the way that it works. Then everybody will be equal. There will be no ruling class. We will all be members of the working class, of the proletariat.
Since everyone's equal, to make everyone equal, and by the way, Animal Farm, some animals are equal. Some are more equal than others. So to make everyone equal, it's important for the socialists to make sure certain people are pushing daisies.
Right.
Even though they're equal, they're going to be pushing daisies to the benefit.
Equal and pushing daisies.
Yes, pushing daisies, 6 foot under the soil, breathing no more, dead, deceased, reached,
you
and become
it.
A corpse, okay?
That's
your point. What they believe. Yeah, this is how whacked out they are. That's the bottom line.
Well, folks, I just want to let you know I was chatting here with Harriet here on Facebook, but I also see that we'll get another message. But I also see that we've got about a little less than 20 minutes of the extended version. It's amazing how fast things go. And then so I would like to leave probably about the last 10 minutes for me to close things out. So we've got about 10 minutes left. And I just want to ask you a question. This is just to indulge me with the ladies. It has pretty much nothing to do with what we talked about tonight. But I know you ladies are well traveled, and so I had to ask: have you ever gone to Ireland?
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about it, because I've always wanted to go there. I'm hoping to perhaps maybe retire there after knowing more about it. So what did you think?
It's very expensive to live in, very beautiful. They have lots of old castles, and you can go kiss the Blarney Stone.
Awesome. Well, I'm Irish, so that's why, you know, I've always to go there. You know, I thought
you want to go kiss the Blarney Stone.
What's that?
I said, do you want to go kiss the Blarney Stone?
I want to go all over the place in Ireland.
Hey, listen, let Natalie tell you about kissing the Blarney Stone, what you have to do to kiss the Blarney Stone.
Oh,
yes,
I heard
we
it's
have
a
to
lot.
Walk
you
up
gotta...
this really old castle, and it's, I mean, it's tearing, it's coming apart. The castle is really in badly need of repair. But walk up these narrow steps up to like the second or third floor, and the sides don't even have railings. You just kind of walk around, and you have to kind of go around the entire castle to get to the area where you actually lie on your back, and they kind of push you, so you're kind of hanging in space, except for they're holding onto your legs so that you can kiss the Blarney Stone. But apparently,
right. Once
you kiss the Blarney Stone, you have the gift. You're given the gift of gab. So
well,
I don't really think
that.
Any of you guys need to kiss the Blarney Stone.
No, but you can stay away from the Blarney Stone.
Other than saying that I've done it, yeah. No,
I didn't do it.
There's other things in Ireland
one
that
lady
I would go
that,
see
I started
before
up
I get
and one lady was, that was frozen in this narrow path. She couldn't go up and she couldn't go down. So I decided I'd better not go.
Well, I'd probably go visit, you know, places that Michael Collins has been, and probably go to, you know, the area where they had the Easter Rising, you know, back in 1916, 1918, you know, things of that nature. You visit the different spots where, you know, Ireland gained its independence from England. So, or at least, you know, the Republic of Ireland, not Northern Ireland, which, you know, 6 + 1 = 1 or something like that. I think that's, you know, because they're still trying to get, or 6 + 4 = 1, one Ireland, United Ireland finally. And then there's still, you know, a lot of folks who'd like to see that. And I'm one of those. We'll see. Actually, this Saturday, going to go to a book signing with a good friend of mine, he's actually been on the show. He's been on when we talked about multi-party systems. He's an expert in Irish politics and multi-party systems. We've had him here on the show a couple of times. He's a professor at a college that I went to, and he was actually my professor. Very knowledgeable, has written a lot. He just got done editing a textbook about Northern Ireland, and I actually had the book signing that I'll be going at, so it'll be fascinating. I'm really looking forward to it. But
hear Northern Ireland is really beautiful, and that some of the places there. We met some people from Northern Ireland, from Londonderry, and they said it was really just really safe. And it's kind of, I guess, like Colombia. You think of it as being there because of the publicity, but
right. They
were saying it was really beautiful and very safe.
Yeah,
we haven't been here.
It's not nearly as dangerous as it was before the 80s. Yeah, there was a time it was pretty dangerous up there. It's not as bad now with you know, the peace accords and things of that nature. But I mean, there's still some fighting there, and the IRA is now, you know, pretty much turned into a political party, Sinn Féin, up there in Ireland. But I'll stop. I could talk about Ireland all night. So.
Okay,
studied,
you
want to
talk about another country? Name one.
What's that?
I said, name another country that you'd like to talk about.
No, just Ireland.
Yeah, I have a question about another country.
Okay.
Have you been to South Africa?
Yes.
well, ta-da, yes. Well, you know, when Nelson Mandela finally, you know, got in there into power, he proceeded, he was all the big, you know, democracy, equality and all that. But then he proceeded to appoint all these communists in his administration, and so the country, it appears that it's going towards communism. Is that correct, or am I wrong, or is that going too far?
It's a fairly on-point question. Go ahead.
Well, we were there, what, 2003, 2004, yeah. So it's been a while. I'm going to tell you, South Africa is a very beautiful country, and it surprised me a lot. Cape Town area, which usually that's where you start out, was very nice. But then when we went to Johannesburg, that was the biggest surprise, because when we went to Johannesburg, the buildings, the downtown area, it was boarded up. The corporations, companies left downtown at that time. I remember going by the Hilton. I think it was a Hilton or a Hyatt. It was all boarded up, but the squatters came in. People came in. They were living in those buildings, just living there. And it was kind of a ghost town. In fact, when we drove through downtown, they wouldn't even stop at the red lights, fearing the fact that, if you stop, they'll rob the car, and take the parts of the car, and then go sell them on the side of the road, which we saw many of those. So I'm not as keen on South Africa as some other people are, but it's just because what we saw at that time, you know, we did get a lot of information about Mandela. We kind of saw a different view of Mandela. And kind of when he became the president, how the direction South Africa went. To me at the time when we saw it, it was not a thriving country. It wasn't a place. Let's put it this way. I could not wait to get out. The fear,
wow.
Especially Johannesburg, not Cape Town, but Johannesburg, where they would tell you that you don't even call the police. You know, these homes, these subdivisions, you know, they have their own police, because if they called the police would never go. They would never go there. So they couldn't even depend on their own law enforcement for protection. They had to take it into their own hands. But that was
South Africa.
But it could have changed then.
Are there, like, no white people living in Johannesburg anymore?
They live in little protected compounds with large walls, and on top are barbed wire and these pieces of broken glass that are set into concrete to keep people out.
Yeah, I've seen that a lot in Mexico and Colombia. They all have that too. I guess maybe Venezuela's getting that too. It wasn't there when I was there.
We did not see that in Colombia.
And if it was there, it had taken them down.
I
remembered seeing some of it. We actually went to a neighborhood one time when we were there that was a very
important... Well, I wouldn't doubt it. Yeah, but it really has changed a lot
in the last few years.
Yeah, 2002. Mm-hmm.
Have you ever been to Egypt?
Yes.
That's another place I'd like to see.
Egypt is very
country.
We went there in 2006. And we really enjoy the antiquities. I mean, I'm just in love with that, and really love to, very interested in that history. The people are very friendly, but even at that point when we went, we were with a very small group of Americans, and we actually had bodyguards. While we were in the van traveling
with Uzis,
with AK-47s.
Wow!
But it was really enjoyable. But it's a very poor country, of course, and they've mastered the art of selling. So as Americans go to Egypt, those people that are trying to sell whatever product they had in their hands at the time. They will stay on you until you can get back to your destination, and they won't let you go.
They're like pesky mosquitoes. They just stay right on top of you, wanting to sell you stuff and giving it to you, putting it in your hands, and then asking for money for it.
Yeah,
so that's easy.
Yeah.
But I enjoyed it, but I'm not sure I would go there now.
No, I wouldn't go there now.
I was going to ask you that. Yeah, I was going to ask you that. You wouldn't go back, would you?
Not right now, no. Mm-mm.
No. Well, so what, ladies and gents, I see we only get about 10 minutes of the extended version, so what I like to do here is give our guests a few minutes to close things out, and then we'll have you, Kelly, and then you, Cindy, to give some parting words, and then I'll proceed to close out the show. So go ahead, Natalie and Evelyn. Thank you very much, ladies, for coming to the show. We really enjoyed having you on here, and hopefully we'll be able to talk with you guys again in the future.
I've really enjoyed it, and I would like to say my parting word, eternal vigilance is the price of freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you very much. It really has been very informative. I enjoyed a lot of the comments. We like to take that as we go forward and try to educate Americans. But like I said, I wasn't so surprised about the propaganda of Cuba. What I was really surprised about were the Americans, and the reason is because we just take our freedom for granted, and we think it when we leave the United States and we go to another country, we're just assuming they're just like that as well, and so we're not opening up our eyes and we're not seeing, you know, the surroundings around us. My concern, the Americans are too interested in the Kardashians and not interested in
mm-hmm.
enough in really seeing what's going on and you know, making a statement about it. Talk about vigilance. That's extremely important, that we don't allow these small little things, because the small little things are the things you don't see. And then all of a sudden there's so many small little things that creates this huge big thing, and then all of a sudden it's too late. Just like those Cubans, it was too late for them to even do anything after they took the arms, you know, the guns away, and they threatened their lives. It was too late, so they had to get out. We cannot do that here in the United States. We have got to keep our eyes open. Thank you.
Go ahead.
No,
I
just
want
to say we enjoyed
this.
And,
they're
closed right now.
Oh, okay. Go ahead, Cindy.
Well, I want to thank you ladies so much for coming on. It really stirs us up when we talk about this issue, because we see the way our country's going, and it's so disappointing, and it just makes you want to scream. And I would like to say to any Democrat who might get a hold of this in archives or whatnot, that please watch what these ladies are saying. Watch these things happening here. Go visit a communist nation and see if that's what you want for this nation. If you're a Democrat and you're a leader and you think that it's a good thing for us to go social, please go look at other countries. Go stay there for a year. Go stay there for even a month, and get among the people, the regular people, and just see what kind of life they live. And listen, some of them will tell you that they're okay with their life. I've talked to a lot of Canadians that are just fine with their health program, and basically that's because they're into it two generations now. And the new generations don't know any better. They don't know
right.
what it would have been like before. And so, you know, you look at the generation after generation of Russia and China, they don't see any difference. They don't know what it was like before, or they don't know what it could be like here in the United States. They have no idea how we live in the United States. And so you really can't – you just have to look at how they're living, ask them questions, and you will find out that is not the way you want to live. And you look at what the media is doing, how we have the media telling us all kinds of lies. They're in control of everything. You're losing your rights, and pretty soon you're going to lose your guns if you're not careful. And when you see all these things coming to pass,
you need to ask yourself, okay, this is the same thing that happened in the communist country. Do I want this to happen? Or do I want to do something about it? Anyway, that's my two cents, and thank you so much, ladies, for being here.
And you.
And Kelly, you have the floor.
You know, I absolutely love to hear women's perspectives. They have an edge over us guys with things, and I'm just like, wow. I am so glad these ladies graced us with their presence. And yeah, I'm still a little stunned, so I don't have much more to say.
Thank you so much, Kelly. We appreciate it.
But definitely, I want to send the thanks up to you ladies, too, for coming on. It was great having you on. As I said, you're welcome to come back, even if you want to call into the show on any topics that we might have and chime in, because here, as you've seen on Bard's Logic, we have open mics where people can call in and join our roundtable discussion, which we do every Wednesday at 10 p.m. Eastern Time. And so I'd like to ask those folks to check out the Bard's Logic Political Talk website at www.bardslogicpoliticaltalk.com. And also check us out on Facebook. Please share and like the page. And you can just go to the search engine, put in Bard's Logic Political Talk, and we'd appreciate a like there. I haven't actually asked people to do that for a while, so I thought I'd get back to that. And so I do see I only have a few moments here, so we'll see everyone next week where we'll be promoting the Twitter event from the PatriotJournalist.com. Check that out, where you'll be looking at Twitter and seeing the hashtag #PrayToEndAbortion. And that'll be on the 22nd, so check that out. And that's happening from 1 p.m. to 11 p.m., and that's Eastern Time. And so I will end tonight, as I do every night, and I ask folks to stay and listen to the song by Aubrey Ashburn. And you can hear more of her music by going to www.aubreyashburn.com. Take care, folks. Have a good night.
Bye.
And we will
see
you again. Thank you. Take care.